Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Go. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! A very happy entree into the official summer of 2008 to you all, wherever you may be. Well, in the northern hemisphere, I suppose. Happy winter to those of you in the southern hemisphere. There, we got that all squared away now. First day of winter for John Fox, first day of summer for me here in the hills. It is the 20th day of June. It is the 145th birthday of the state of West Virginia. This is a day special and cherished to all us mountaineers, wherever we may be. 145 years since Abraham Lincoln tap danced on the Constitution and carved one state out of another, but never mind, we won't get into the petty petty differences regarding the foundation of this state. Hell, if West Virginia hadn't been formed, how would we have created a third world state to rape all the coal out of? I mean, those Virginia planters might not have cotton too well, but never mind. So that's where we are this evening. It's Friday. I've managed to show, Tuesday and Friday. Monday was a technical nightmare. Wednesday and Thursday, I was gone to Morgantown with Ferg for a middle schooler's health sciences seminar that he got invited to. And wow, was it cool. Learned a lot of things in my return to beautiful, beautiful Morgantown, West Virginia. Found out that it turns out the state's actually serious about getting West Virginians to get healthcare educations, health sciences educations, and hopefully stay in West Virginia. Even found out that there are programs that will mentor West Virginia students from ninth grade through 12th in high school. If they complete the program, they will then go on and have all tuition paid at WVU as long as they major in some health science. And that if they then manage to get into one of the state's three medical schools, they'll pay for that too. That's pretty darned impressive. And of course, they wanted to, the folks hosting the seminar wanted to show off the campus, which is pretty darned impressive, I must say. It's changed considerably since I rode up there on my dinosaur and matriculated some 25 years ago. And they did show it to us. And in a true spirit of encouraging healthy lifestyles for middle-aged parents, they walked our butts off. I'm moving around like a 90-year-old man right now. There is a reason that when I was there, I wore a pair of size 34 Levi's, weighed 185 pounds, sopping wet. And, yeah, and weigh about 100 pounds more than that now, bone dry. But we're working on getting back to the size 34 Levi's now that I'm starving again. So, I don't know. Maybe it'll all work out for the best. But they walked us all over. Saw just beautiful, beautiful, beautiful renovations. The population of WVU, student population, was about 18,000, including everybody, when I was there. In the 25 years since I have gone, or graduated, it has risen to something on the order of nearly 30,000. Woo! A lot of students, a lot of growth, and just, Morgantown, for those of you who have never been there, is just a beautiful place. It is just a beautiful place. And Ferg was dutifully impressed. We stayed in the dormitory. It's sort of modeled on the towers over at Ohio State University. These are the WVU towers. And Ferg was excited about that, too. Got a little homesick. But it was all right. And he learned a bunch, and I learned a bunch. And we got to tour the football stadium and the Coliseum, home of the football and basketball programs. It was just, it was information packed. It was very well put on, and they certainly put WVU's best foot forward. So that's what I did with the last 2 days. By the time I got home yesterday evening, I had been so isolated from information. I mean, no TV, no radio, and the downside of WVU is that everything costs something. So when I said, hey, y'all got wireless internet here in, these here highfalutin dormitories? They said, yes, we do, for a $25 one-time fee. And I said, very nice. I'll go sit with the laptop in the McDonald's parking lot when I get a chance. And that's what I did. Because I got to check email. But no time to really sit there and absorb information. But we could be at war with the entire world by now, and I wouldn't have known it. Because I was just laser beam focused in on trying to figure out ways to get my kids through college and hopefully have it be a meaningful experience for them. So by the time I got home yesterday, it was too late for me to do a show, and I had no idea what's going on. So I've spent the day sort of catching up. And for an information junkie, that information isolation is positively disorienting. And I am, as you know, an information junkie. But I've caught up. Oh, there was... Yeah, we're not going to hurt for stuff to talk about tonight. No, I don't think so. While up there, of course... Okay, here's what it boils down to. I'm never leaving home. I'm never leaving home again. Every time I turn my back, something crappy happens. From the capitulation of the Democratic Party in Congress for funding the war, which went down before I left, to the capitulation of the Congress this morning in agreeing to just sort of put paid to that whole idea of the Fourth Amendment. I have seen a sickening display of spinelessness that just, well, like I said, it was a sickening display of spinelessness. Lucky for me, I've got some anti-nausea medication left over from my trip to the emergency room a few weeks back. I may yet have to take it. Makes me a little bit loopy, but it makes me not want to vomit. On the other hand, the Democratic Party in Congress, especially in the House of Representatives, sincerely makes me want to vomit. And it's especially galling when they're doing that at the same time that you're receiving a blast email from Nancy Pelosi, a message for you, Bob, from Speaker Pelosi, telling me how important it is to elect a stronger Democratic majority in the House this fall. What for? What are you going to do with it, Nance? Put together a coalition of the willing? Willing, that is, to appease and capitulate to George Bush. To throw away the blood sacrifices of our forefathers and foremothers who fought and bled and died to keep the Fourth Amendment alive so that a Vichy Democrat like you could lead the charge of a bunch of blue dog mugwumps to destroy what they fought and died for. You know, I tell you what, Nancy, I'll start writing checks when you start acting like a Democrat. I got a feeling my checkbook's safe for a long damn time. Let's have a look. Let's have a look at the final vote total. Survey says the final vote total of the of H.R. 6304, the FISA Amendments Act of 2008, as it went down today at 12:48 p.m., 293 yays to 129 noes. Wow, That's pretty big. That's a lot. The 129 noes were comprised of 128 Democrats and one Repiglican. That is not the galling part. The galling part, as you well know, would be the 293. Voting for the destruction of the Fourth Amendment. Voting to give George Bush the right to spy on anybody he damned well pleases and giving immunity to the telecoms. Now, what do we get for this? What do we get? Do I get better? You know, does the phone service get better for this? Do we get a lower bill because AT&T and Verizon and the rest of these sleazy bastards get to spy on us as long as George Bush tells them to? Do we get that? No, they just get immunity from lawsuit. When they listen in and they happen to get Aunt Mabel's secret fudge recipe, and then Cindy McCain winds up putting it on her website as yours, you can't sue the damn phone company for stealing it from you and give it... But never mind. 293 to 129. What a shameful tally. Of that 293, 188 were, of course, Repiglicans, authoritarians, fascists, rotten, pathetic excuses for members of the human race, pod people, if you ask me. But in that list of 293 minus 188 leaves a difference of 105. 105 Democrats. Democrats like Ackerman, Altmaier, Arcuri, Baca, Baird, Bean, Berkeley, Beeman, Berry, Bishop Georgia, Bishop New York, Boren, Boswell, Boucher, Boyd, Boyda, Brown, Butterfield, Cardoza, Carney, Castor, Kazayu. Wait a minute, why do I recognize that name? Clyburn, Cleaver, Childers, Chandler, Cooper, Costa, Kramer, Cuellar, Davis, Arter Davis. Arter Davis, who's done such a beautiful job from time to time, peeling these administration thugs like a grape, capitulated. Lincoln Davis, Dix, oh, that's appropriate, Donnelly, Ellsworth, Rahm Emanuel, Rahm Emanuel, you old son of a bitch, never mind, Engel, Etheridge, Murphy, Moore, Mitchell, Melancon, Meeks, McNerney, Matheson, Marshall, Mahoney. Yeah, I could be screaming these names, but why would you? Why would you scream about mugwumps behaving like mugwumps? Why would you behave? Are you surprised? Are you surprised that our party contains 105 Vichy Democrats? 105 Bush capitulators? 105 Bush appeasers? And yeah, let me work down the list here. Ray Hall, my congressman. You know, the other night, the boss, Wayne, called in. And he said, we gotta call them when Congress people get them right. We may have some differences of opinion from time to time, but when they get them right, we gotta mention it, because we hammer them when they get them wrong. We gotta give them credit when they get them right. And that was to talk about Ray Hall's use it or lose it position on oil companies and federal land leases. And I agreed with him. For the most, yeah. Tell them when they get it right. But just as quick as we do something like that, they turn around and slip the shiv to us. Now, today, somewhere along the way, while he was voting to take a big steamer on the Constitution of the United States, Congressman Ray Hall found time to rise in the House of Representatives and said, "Madam Speaker, I rise today in recognition of the 145th birthday of my home state, West Virginia. The most violent conflict in the history of our nation, the Civil War, gave America a new definition of freedom, strengthened the role of the federal government, and ultimately reconciled our fractured union." Guess you won't be mentioning the part about how it preserved the Constitution there, Congressman, because you were part of taking a dump on it today. But never mind. For West Virginians, the 1861 to 1865 conflict remains significant for another reason. Virginia was rendered in two, East and West, and a new state, West Virginia, was born. This Friday marks the 145th birthday of the state of West Virginia. I ask all West Virginians, the hardest working, most hospitable, and most patriotic people in the United States, to join me in celebrating how far our state has come. Well, that's debatable how far we've come. We were born out of conflict. We were immediately subjected to the depredations of the railroad, timber, and extractive mining industries. And, hey, wait a minute. We still are. That's not a lot of distance between point A and point B. There's so little difference between point A and point B that I think mathematically and geometrically you could say that A equals B. And B equals A. Same, same. West Virginians have long known their uniqueness and celebrated it. As the only state to be formed by seceding from its parent state, West Virginia, well, New Mexico, sort of, but they didn't secede. They were sort of carved away, but we won't talk about that little bit of unpleasantness back when James K. Polk made the United States, well, the Mexican War was to James K. Polk what Iraq is to George Bush, but it worked out a little better for Polk. West Virginia blazed a trail of independence of mind and spirit. Well, except for the West Virginians who were treated like slaves and not even paid in real money, Nick. That was called scrip. And they were beaten to death, shot, killed, burned alive, tortured and tormented for trying to form a union. But we won't talk about that nasty little dust-up between people wanting to be human beings and the coal companies that didn't want them to be. You know, folks like my grandfather, my great-grandfather. We'll just forget about them, okay? Their blood didn't matter. Besides, you're pissing away the Constitution, so that doesn't really matter so much anyway. Many historic figures have lived and traveled through the Mountain State on their way to shaping the course of our nation's history. Daniel Boone settled and lived in present-day Kanawha County. Stonewall Jackson, the stalwart Civil War general who fought for slavery, was born in Clarksburg. And Pearl S. Buck, Pulitzer Prize and Nobel Prize winning author, was born in Hillsborough, Pocahontas County. Interestingly, it was Pearl S. Buck who said, she being so good with words, that you can tell the most about a society by how it treats its poorest. Guess we kind of forgot that one, too. Whoopsie. Many modern-day heroes and stars also hail from the hills of West Virginia. Jennifer Garner, oh, my heart goes pitter-pat, who received a Golden Globe for her performances on ABC's hit television drama Alias, is a Charleston native. Chuck Yeager, who broke the sound barrier and has used his influence to promote scholarship and development opportunities for the state, was born in Myra. The mining town of Colwood in McDowell County is now world-renowned as the home of Homer Hickam, best-selling author of Rocket Boys, upon which the award-winning 1999 motion picture October Sky was based. In addition to celebrities, both historical and modern, West Virginia's elected leaders have brought vision and opportunity to our state, not to mention mountaintop removal. Most notable, Senator Robert C. Byrd, the big daddy of West Virginia politics, is the longest-serving senator in history and has secured billions of dollars, billions and billions, for the future of our state. He remains a force to be reckoned with in the Senate with his longevity and leadership. You forgot a couple of heroes there, Nick. How about Ed Wiley? How about Ed Wiley, who walked all the way from West Virginia to Washington, D.C., to beg you to stand up for his granddaughter and children like her so that they could stop breathing and absorbing poison at Marsh Fork Elementary School, and you turned a deaf ear on him, Nick. How about Ed Wiley? He's a hero to me. How about Judy Bonds, Nick? She has faced the wrath of an entire geographic region for nothing more than standing up against seeing that region forever destroyed. She has more courage in her little finger, Nick, than you've got in your entire being. How about Judy Bonds? How about Maria Gonneau, who had so much guts that she was willing to get on the stand in a courtroom, place her hand in the air, and swear before Almighty God that mountaintop removal is destroying her home and has destroyed her community, and for her troubles was met with death threats and harassment, and can't leave her home without somebody in it for fear of being burned out. How's that for courage and guts and accomplishment, Nick? Why couldn't you mention them? They're my heroes. They're damn sure my heroes. They're such heroes of mine that I say it every night. The hardest working, bravest people that I know. And by mentioning two or three names, I'm leaving out 1,000 others. You want heroes, Nick Rahal. You go down Route 3, and you meet some of the people I know. And they'll teach you a thing or two about courage, Nick Rahal. A lot more courage than you showed today when you lined up with the capitulators and the appeasers and you voted to put a stake through the heart of the Fourth Amendment, Nick Rahal. Nick, you make me wonder where the cutoff point is sometimes, buddy. But, of course, Very much like an article I read, I think, out of the New Yorker about Keith Olbermann, where at the end of it, the producer of his show said of the Hillary Clinton supporters ceasing watching Keith Olbermann, he said, they'll be back. Where are they going to go? Where are they going to go? They got nowhere else. And you count on that, don't you, Nick? Even though you spat on the Constitution, even though you've treated it, in the words of George W. Bush, like a GD piece of paper, you know that we'll be back. Because you know that we can always count on the Republicans to run some right-wing, Bible-thumping, gay-hating, gun-toting freak against you. And that those are the only two choices we'll have on the ballot in November. And where are we going to go? Going to stay home? Can't stay home. Nick, I tell you what, you're putting me in a spot. You're making it real hard on me, Nick. Because I voted for you in the past. And I'd be inclined to vote for you again. But you're making it really difficult. The mountaintop removal, the sycophancy is bad enough. But what you did today to the United States Constitution is something approaching unforgivable. It truly, truly is. So happy birthday from, happy birthday, West Virginia, from Nick Rahal. Happy 145th. Be nice if you could see 146, West Virginia, without another mountain being blown up, but your happy birthday greetings from Nick Rahal don't extend that far. He closes his remarks in the House today. John Denver was right. West Virginia truly is almost heaven. Happy birthday, West Virginia. Wishing West Virginia happy birthday has a certain bittersweet quality to it. It has something sort of painful about it. Because the pains of our birth have gone on and on and on without ceasing. Families tortured by the railroad and coal companies 6 generations, 8 generations ago are still being tortured, and we're still waiting for someone, somewhere, in a representative capacity to recognize it. So happy birthday, West Virginia. Many, many returns, and someday, hopefully, happy ones. We'll go to the phones and take your calls when we come back. This is America's Liberal Voice. This is The Horn.
Almost level. West Virginia, flattened mountains, gold-filled in our river. Life is cheap there, cheaper by the ton. We lose more by law here than if they use a gun. Strip mine roads, ruin my home. All the places. Within her, lassies run off, poison in the water, black and filthy, mercury in the sky, poison taste of arsenic, fly ash in my eye, strip my robe. Virginia. ship, buying him a government. $1.7 million dirty bucks to take away our justice, haul it off in his coal truck. On these roads I'll fight for home and the hills where I belong. West Virginia, I'll fight for mama. This is my home. Down country roads, this is my home. I'll fight for home.
Dang gum, if Tanya Adkins doesn't choke you up a little bit and put a chill up your spine, you may want to check for a pulse because you might not be alive. Tanya Adkins can slap sing. And not bad back there with the flat pick and get fiddle and the little 8-string misery box neither. Wow. I wrote the lyric and she's got me teared up and weeping. Wow. Let's go to the phones. Hi, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, what's up?
Not much. I've been missing you, man.
I've been missing being here. Monday was a technological abortion, and Tuesday and Wednesday were just, Cook's Day off.
Yep. I wanted to do another prayer meeting thing with you. I have, update episode number 3 of the liberal and the religious people.
Oh, God. I'm almost afraid, Vince.
Actually, this one isn't quite so bad. Last time I spoke to you, just to recap, my boss's brother, while we were out there sweating and digging and whatnot, they asked me who I was voting for, and we got into the whole, is Obama a Muslim or is he an American Christian or whatever. I still can't figure out what the heck he was on. But
don't try. It hurts.
So anyways, the next day I worked, because that was on Tuesday, and then I didn't work Wednesday or Thursday or Friday because my boss was on vacation that week. On Monday or Tuesday, I don't remember exactly which day it was, I was working with my boss this day, the actual owner of the company, the guy's brother.
Yeah, back from...
And this was the first time I'd worked with my boss by with just him. Every time I've worked with him before, he's been there. And one thing I noticed is that when he's not around his brother, he doesn't pray over his food and hold up the drive-thru line.
Really? It's a public, hi, I'm Dr. Phil, and I'm listening. Would the praying brother be the older brother or the younger brother?
The praying brother would be the younger brother.
Okay, so we've got some sibling dynamics at work here.
Yeah. So, anyways, but the plot thickens, okay? I'm not done yet.
Just like a good gravy.
So we're sitting here. And we're driving. We were on our way up to Jekyll Island, I think, to do some sort of pest control thing. I don't even remember. But we were on our way up there, and here comes the question. So now, who are you voting for? And once again, if I was smart...
Oh, you didn't do it twice now, did you?
Yes, I did.
Vince, brother, we got to talk.
No, but this didn't turn out quite so bad, because I kind of been feeling this out for a little while because, I had noticed this thing earlier about the whole, he doesn't get so crazy when his brother's around and whatnot, when his brother ain't around and whatnot. And I said, well, I'm probably voting for Obama. And he goes, oh, okay. And I said, who are you voting for? And he goes, well, I'm probably voting for McCain, but I'm not all that enthused about it. And I said, why not? And to make a long story short, we had a very, very, very long, drawn-out political conversation. And you know what? The guy, I don't agree with a lot of the reasons why he thinks the way he does, but he actually has reasons for the things that he believes in, whatnot.
And they're not just half-crazed, deluded right-wing talking points?
Exactly. And I'll tell you, there's hope yet, because at the end of the conversation, I said, well, I'll be honest with you. I said, McCain wasn't, or McCain, Obama wasn't my first choice. I said Edwards was, and he piped up, I liked Edwards. And I said, really? He goes, yeah, I really did like Edwards. And I said, well, I said, I wanted Edwards, and it's just, I got to pick who I got to pick with. And I said, but I'll tell you something. Obama might be Obama, and Clinton may be Clinton, but I would have voted for any of them, because you got to look at one thing. I know you're thinking, because he mentioned he was going to vote for McCain because he had to. I said, I know you're thinking that you're Republican, and you got to vote your party line. I said, but you got to look at them. Do you like where this country is right now, as it has been in the last 3 years under President George W. Bush? And I said, now you don't have to answer that, but if the answer is no, then you have to look at the policies of McCain. And you'll find that McCain's policies, you know, dollar for donuts is pretty much the exact same thing. You're, in essence, voting for a third Bush term. And I said, now I'm not going to say voting for Obama is going to turn this country around, and I'm not going to say that voting for Obama is going to result in a better thing. I don't know that. I said, what I do know is that if you vote for McCain, you're voting for a third Bush term, and I just don't think we can afford that. And he sat there for a second, and there was silence for a second, and he goes, you know, I didn't think of it that way.
Well, he's either being honest with you or you're going to be fired sometime next week. Oh, God,
No, because, I mean, if he'd have let me go, he'd have let me go already. I had to call out yesterday because of some bad food or something made me sick. I mean, he's had ample opportunity to fire me since then. And
I tried to tell you guys about staying off the tomatoes.
No, it wasn't the tomatoes that did it, I don't think. But it had tomatoes. But anyways, no, he just, I mean, we've actually had a couple different, mostly it's been getting away from the politics and we've been talking more about economics, but I mean, we've been having quite a number of conversations just sitting in the car and whatnot, going from hither to yonder. And, you know, but I find it really interesting that, you know, he's the older brother, and you know, he gets all, you know, religious and everything when brother's around, but you take his younger brother out of it, and I mean, he don't like me cussing or nothing, and you know, out of respect and, you know, not wanting to cuss around the boss man, I don't.
Well, you know, you know what? I don't necessarily see that as a proof of fundamentalist influence.
I don't either.
There are words that I would feel inclined to say a lot of the time on this program that I don't. Even though, you know, this isn't censored radio, this isn't government radio like what happens over the air, and I can say anything I doggone well please, but I have respect for the fact that there are people around me in the form of, you know, out there in computer land who have little Susie and little Timmy around, or people who just are personally put off by hearing that. You know, there's a great quote from Kurt Vonnegut, and I think I've mentioned it in the past, where he says that, and it's in the guise of a former Army officer from Vietnam, who said, "I always told my troops that I would not swear at them because swearing is an automatic pass for anyone who doesn't want to listen to you to tune you out." And he said, "I won't swear because I don't want you to tune me out, because someday what I have to say may save your life." And that's what his character said. And, you know, there's a lot of truth in that. I know there are people that, no matter how much I would like to use it sometimes, there are people who are profoundly put off by the GD word. And that's why even though George Bush referred to the Constitution as a GD piece of paper.
A GD piece of paper, yeah.
I won't use that quote. Because it is so off-putting to so many people. And I reckon, you know, while I don't necessarily share a lot of people's faiths, I do at least go far enough as to try not to poke them with sharp sticks.
I don't know. If Bush is saying it and you're quoting him, I would give him the full quote just because that's what he said, and he should, you know, if that's all putting to you, I didn't say it, the president said it.
Yeah, and I think there's journalistic license in that. But heaven forfend, you know, the New York Times won't print it. The New York Times won't... mushmouth journalism in many ways, and maybe I'm guilty of it, but it's part of my upbringing. So, you know, that's what I got. Yeah, I'm trying.
Yeah.
It's common courtesy. And you know what? If you're running a landscape business and somebody, you know, the whacks his foot with a shovel or something. No black stag and blue nose, not pulled frazzle lapping crook. Only uses the real stuff, and the potential customers going by. You know, maybe you're going to be working at the potential customer's place of business, and he doesn't want his customers hearing it. And so it sort of fans outward. So I understand that part. Wow, that was a big diversion. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, Vince.
No, that's all right. And I mean, I can understand it too. He does have the aversion mostly for, because I mean, he is, as he puts it, a man of God, but he's not as fundamentalist crazy as his brother is.
Right.
I just find that to be a very interesting dynamic. And he's a lot more open about, you know, God forbid we even got a little bit on the abortion point of view a little bit, and we didn't say much on it except, you know, I said, you know, hey, I'm pro-choice, but that doesn't mean that I'm all for it. You know, heck, I was raised Catholic, and from my point of view, I don't think it's something you should be doing. I just don't think it's a matter of the government needing to stick its nose in it, you know, and that was really all that we said about it. And I mean, he seems to respect my point of view. So like I said, it was, I found normally that this wouldn't be anything to write home about, but I thought in contrast to the earlier, I thought that would be kind of interesting to put out there.
Well, it is. It's very much so. And I've come to, sort of think about you during the week and wonder what the next step's going to be. So at least you know
I'm not fired.
You're not fired, and you don't have to wait for the Frosty to melt as long as baby bro's not in the car.
although I'll be honest with you, Bob, I mean, this job is temporary. It's been temporary for me from the day I started. I know it. My boss does know it, and I don't think I'm going to be Vince from Georgia for much longer. Me and my wife have been looking around, and Bob, there just aren't any jobs here.
No, they're not, and even what jobs there are don't pay.
Well, exactly. I mean, you know, it's like I can go right now, and I can go click on the local newspaper's website and go to the classified section here and bring it up. Give it a second. Okay, click on the employment section, and there are 26 listings. Now, I open those 26 listings up, and of those listings, there's some stupid advertisement in here about that's not even employment-related. Most of them are medical jobs out of someplace else that just end up in our paper for some stupid reason. Of all the jobs that are for here, it's either work at home, which is usually somebody trying to scam you, and basically, you know, like management positions in fast food places. There's like maybe those and a couple contractor jobs. Of course, the truck drivers are always advertising, but these are all jobs that like people put in our newspaper because they know people here are looking for jobs. They're not local jobs.
No. So if you're not going to be Vince from Georgia, are you looking in any particular place?
Well, we're probably going to be moving down into Florida.
Oh, that's risky, brother.
Into Jacksonville. I mean,
That's a hard place to be.
It's the closest city that there is here.
Yeah, true.
You know.
Yeah, a lot closer to you than Atlanta by far.
Very much closer to me than Atlanta. And there's just no jobs. I mean, there's no jobs here, and you're right. The ones that are here, you know, you can't make off of them. And we're fighting over our sheriff, who's a corrupt piece of junk. And, you know, there's so much, I don't want to say drama, because it's not really drama, but I mean, the local government is fighting about so much stupid stuff that it shouldn't even be fought over, you know what I mean? And they're doing absolutely nothing to improve the situation around here. Of course, we'll approve, you know, if some developer wants to come in and build, you know, a multi-million dollar gated community for all the rich folks to come in here, we'll streamline that through. But by God, somebody wants to come in here and, you know, build a cellulose plant or something that might, you know, actually bring some jobs into the economy, it gets put on the back burner and gets sent to committees and this, that, and the other. Eventually people say,
hey, what happened to that? Oh, it went away. Yeah. A little advice coming your way, Vince, out of the chat room. Saying you need to read the Jacksonville newspaper first because nothing's any better there. See, that's the thing. This is what you're experiencing there in small-town Georgia is happening all over the country. And I'm not trying to be a downer, but it's true. I mean, there are places where there is some growth and stuff, but they're few and far between. I mean, it's construction season. I was up in Morgantown yesterday. Construction going on all over the place. And most of the, you know, all the construction being done is being done by guys who are getting $8 an hour. And it's backbreaking labor. So.
Oh, yeah.
What I'm getting at is that is the America that George Bush has given us. George Bush has given us an $8 an hour America.
Well, there's something uniquely American about someone working three jobs.
Bingo! You got it! You know, and that idiotic woman, the congresswoman from Minnesota, who now has added to her list of famous remarks by saying drilling in Anwar will be great because caribou will cozy up and get warm next to the pipelines. No, really. Was the same same idiot who said not too long back that she's proud because Minnesota has the highest percentage of people working more than one job.
That's nothing to be proud of, lady.
No, but she's a Republican, so don't expect a hell of a lot to be going on between her ears. But, you know, that's me. Hey, Vince, I'm glad this one turned out better. But we'll be waiting for the update next week, okay?
All right,
hang in there, brother.
All right, talk to you later. Oh, can you do me a favor?
I can try.
Can you write down an email? It's a public email address.
Yepers.
For me.
Mm-hmm.
It's vmnovak@gmail.com. Can you send me the direct link to the chat room? Because I can't get in it from the website.
I think the chat room has just heard that, and I'll bet you ELO will shoot you that link post-haste.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Hey, thanks, Vince. Talk to you soon, brother.
Talk to you later, Bob.
Bye now. Have a great weekend.
Bye. You too.
All right, and onward we go. Hi, welcome to the program.
Welcome back.
Hey, well, glad to be back.
This be Kate.
I know that be Kate. I know your voice anywhere.
Yeah, it's still my voice. I'm glad somebody in the chat room brought that up because he was describing Innerwear USA.
It really is.
Mm-hmm. That's going on. At least he has a job with a boss that's willing to drive to lunch. I mean, it could be worse. It could be worse. Oh, Lord, have mercy. I was just kind of dumbfounded. I mean, they're getting jobs in the newspapers and a place to get the job anyway. So,
but see, this is a story of what has happened, like you say, all over America. You know, it's part, and frankly, you know, it's Friday and it's you and it's me, and I will go ahead and say that. It's part of the Mad Maxing of America.
Well, this is the Mad Max segment. Yeah, it is. Hello. Hello, mate.
And the reason I say that, Kate, is I had an opportunity to start watching Ken Burns's beautiful documentary, The War.
Mm-hmm.
A kind listener was wonderful enough to ship that along to me, and. In watching it, there are all these beautiful old black and white photographs of pre-war, and yeah, even, you know, but it's in the Depression, but it's pre-war, in the Depression, America, and it's small town America. And it's an America that has cars on the streets and people walking up and down small town American sidewalks. And I was struck, Kate, by what a difference there is now, because regardless of what towns they were showing, one in Sacramento and one in Minnesota and Mobile, Alabama, and another one's Waterbury, Connecticut.
Yeah.
And regardless of the particular locations, it was a picture of an America that doesn't exist anymore.
Mm-mm.
Because you can go to small town America anywhere, and that doesn't happen. And it's not just because the mall moved out, you know, out to the city outskirts and took all the business with it.
No.
It's because there has been a brain drain out of, you know, small town America used to produce a great, great majority of the genius of this country.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's been a brain drain out of small town America. And, you know, everything short of tumbleweeds and that Clint Eastwood thing. Yeah. It's small town America is dead and or dying.
Yep. Well, and the brains that are left, the IQ has been dropped by about 10 points by the chemicals and the pollutions and the diseases. And
yeah.
What's left is all the people who watch Fox News, I guess. I don't know. I guess I should stop throwing that phrase around because I don't know what Fox News looks like. The damage to people. Anyway, what I did hear though was I have about six headlines of something that just struck me really way off of the energy where I started with the gas tanks getting drained out of the truck stops. I heard a story on NPR the other morning or somewhere about the cocoa plant, the black pod disease in the cocoa plant in a city in Brazil. And up on hills where the trees were growing, the disease hit the pods, and they shriveled and died. And over time, then that kills the tree.
Now, are you talking about cocoa or cacao?
Cacao, sorry.
Okay. No, I'm just trying to clarify.
Thank you. And I do the same for you. Heartbeat. I love it when you leave them wide open and you leave the gate open. You didn't even know it. Oh, man, I'm right there.
Look, I'm not a comedian. I'm the perfect straight man, okay? I am.
What? No, I don't. Anyway, okay, let's don't argue about who's the funniest here, okay, or not. Cacao trees. Anyway.
Oh, I'm definitely straighter than you, and you have to admit that.
No, get out. Okay, there you go. See? Always got to interrupt me. I'm back to the diseased trees.
Okay, back to the diseased cacao trees.
Okay, over time, when the tree dies, then the ecosystem loses the canopy, and then they lose the birds, and then the birds don't, there's nothing to eat the bugs. And as that whole system deteriorates, the ground is completely dry and leveled, and whenever it rains, I mean, there's no vegetation to hold the rain, so there's no groundwater.
Yeah, goodbye topsoil.
I guess, and then the rain washes all the soil and the water, it all runs down into the river off season. Then during the hot season, when the river needs to feed the city, there's no water from underground because all cycle, all back to that black pod disease. And so what struck me was, you know how my mind wanders, and I'm out there all over the place, and it's hard to pull me back in. But I thought, you know, it's not Iran, it's not George Bush, the crime thing, it's not the election, it's not the economy, it's not the oil. That's not what's going to kill us. It's the microbes that are killing us. It's the bugs. They're going to win again.
They always do.
Oh, they do. And so I thought, yeah, I keep saying none of this is important. Why are we all dwelling on this? I mean, Tim Russert's going to die anyway, for Christ's sake, you know. But anyway, and I didn't want to ruin Cindy's family supper, but nothing's very graphic here. But I found in the corners of stuck away in places that things like citrus mites that are spreading through the Rio Grande Valley, they're resistant to all the miticides, you know, the pesticides, but they have specific chemical mites, and they have become, that the citrus mites have become resistant to this miticide. I guess that's how you pronounce it. I've never used it before. And the pesticides that they're using are supposed to slow the infestation down. They don't know that that's happening yet. And that stuff's all manufactured by Bayer. Oh, yes. And then something else that we're looking at around here, there's citrus trees growing on the property I'm on, and there's an inspector who comes through in a pickup every month or something and checks the little white boxes that are hanging in the tree, and I have no idea what she's looking at, but she's got a nice pickup. There's a disease called citrus greening, and it turns the tree kind of a yellow declines and dies, and it hasn't happened here yet, but it's spread by an insect, so I'm assuming that's probably what they're looking for here. Because when you're growing when you're growing citrus for personal use, it has to be inspected, you know, by some agency, I don't know. But this citrus greening is impacting all of the citrus in Asia and Africa and Brazil. And it's starting to infect Florida, and they're really worried about it, the potential of it being hitting California. And just a little bitty bug just taking out the trees. And that's just so scary to me. The national news is finally starting to pay attention to the wheat stem fungus in Kansas. I've been ranking on that for months and months and years about, God, what about the fungus in Kansas? Don't anybody understand the yield is going down and down, and then we get flooded, and now there's no grain, and, oh, my God.
Yeah. You said circles and circles and circles and circles, and it's true.
I know your head's already out there.
No, my head lives out there. What are you talking about?
Mine, too, so I'm just pulling you off the wall.
Yeah, long lasso. But you're right in that regard, in that what gets us is going to be what's the old World War One thing, you know, you never hear the one that gets you. And this is that. It's the stuff we're not paying attention to, and largely but I can draw the line backward. There was Richard Pryor, whom I revere, quite possibly the funniest man that the planet has ever produced, used to say,
smoked funny, but he was funny too. Yeah.
I think he was in the course of talking about
the pipe for shit, but anyway.
Oh, stop it.
All right, I'm sorry, I just interrupted your story. Go ahead.
Bad Mad Max, bad. I think it was in the course of talking about growing up in Peoria and the cockroaches.
Uh-huh.
And he said, you know, we always spray for those cockroaches. And he said, after a while, I went in the kitchen one night and turned the light on. There's a cockroach standing in the middle of the floor. Look up at me and say, hey, Rich, when you going to throw us another one of those decon parties? We ain't got off in weeks, brother.
I used to stomp through my kitchen in Brooklyn and say, if y'all don't get out of here, you're going to have to start paying rent because I'm tired of feeding your butts.
Well, but that's the thing. You know, the entire microbial little bitty critter world is waiting for another decon party because,
right.
You know, thanks to Bayer and Ortho and, you know, all the Dow and all the Better Living Through Chemistry guys.
The ConAgra people.
We've created bugs that resist everything that we throw at them. You know, the problems that we have with Staphylococcus in hospitals, it extends to our farm fields as well. And it's not just farm fields here. It's farm fields, like you noted, around the world.
That's what I had another story that came up with from the CDC was doing, you know, they're out there doing research on that drug-resistant staph infection, you know, that flesh-eating disease.
Yeah.
And they, like, well, I was just going to go off on a tangent, and they found it to be alarming. They were assuming that this was all related to nursing facilities and hospitals. But an alarming 17% they did a really broad study, like in Baltimore and Atlanta and in Minnesota, so they had a broad spectrum of the geography and cultures and bad. And 17% of the people tested that have weren't even related to the health care facilities. And so, you know, they were just knowing that this is all because the hospitals are not doing their jobs and stuff. And the staph infection that's hit Washington State really badly is called, I can't pronounce the other word, C. diff. It's C-diff.
Yeah.
That's just eating people up. Like it's a colon. It's a bacteria that's living in the colon, and it's mostly coming from. When they use the wrong antibiotic on it, what it does is kill the good germs, and then the spores from this thing explode, and just it's some terminal. They've had already about 1,000 people die in Quebec and they've had about over 4,000 cases of it in Washington. So it's gotten to be, I don't know that they're calling it an epidemic. I doubt that they do that, but that it's the, it, that's not even the flesh-eating disease. So anyway, sorry, Cindy's family. Go on to something else.
Yeah, but
last week she wrote in and said we were sitting here eating dinner and
just, yeah, and see that's the thing, you know, if you're sitting at a little 5,000 watt flickering candle flame, and you're talking to people in a 50-mile radius, you're pretty much you got an idea of what's going on. When your broadcast is globalized like the Horn is, God only knows. You know, it's like the old joke about, you know, I never drink without a reason. Mail's in, sun's up, somebody's birthday somewhere. You know, it's dinner time somewhere when this broadcast is going. And so that means, you know, you guys either got to tough it out or I got to change the direction of the program. And, you know, I got a pretty good idea which one of those is going to lose.
Yeah, well.
Because there's no getting around talking about some of this stuff. You know, I remember, it's covered beautifully in... I love Michael Pollan's work, Pollan. One of his first books, if not the first, was The Botany of Desire. And his thesis was that plants have modified us as much as we have modified plants.
Oh, yeah.
And he had, there was a chapter on the Dutch tulip mania. There was a chapter on marijuana. There mm-hmm. was a chapter on apples and a chapter on potatoes.
Mm-hmm.
And in potatoes, it was his first foray into the whole Frankenfoods thing. And he
on potatoes?
On potatoes, because Monsanto or, you know, one of those monstrous corporate nightmare outfits
mm-hmm.
actually took, oh, God, they took a gene from a goat's belly or something like that and spliced it into the potato. So that, you know, somewhere noxious, somewhere that, you know, clearly it was one of these, you know, some of these things are all like the others. One of these things does not belong, you know, the Sesame Street lesson.
Mm-hmm.
But they took the doesn't belong and merged it into the potato, and I can't remember from what. But it was also that the potato leaf aphid or whatever it was, around here we
mm-hmm.
just call them tater bugs,
mm-hmm.
would bite into the potato, and then the juice that it sucked out would contain this gene that would then kill the bug. And all the food scientists at Monsanto went, aren't we clever?
Can't you just see the trouble that would bring?
And but the thing is, they're still doing it. But among other things, for instance, McDonald's had signed a contract to make all of their French fries out of Frankenspuds. Lay's had signed a contract to make all their potato chips out of Frankenspuds until the public got wind of it and went, well, that's fine, then we just don't eat McDonald's fries and Lay's potato chips anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And they went, oh, really? You guys are serious about that? Yeah, oh, we're very serious.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you can screw with America's political system all you want. You can screw the American people all you want. You can reduce their wages to 3 1/4 an hour all you want.
And we're, eyes alone.
Did you hear he was a Muslim? But if you, with our potato chips or our French fries, we will have your ass.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there's furthering that wheat, that grain story with the modifications, that may work. However, I mean, you know,
it worked.
In the short term, it might work. But when we run out of the grain, it's just there's a brand new fungus a wheat fungus that was formerly only in Yemen and East Africa has now moved into Iran. And the UN Food and Agriculture is they're going nuts because the country, India's on high alert and it's already moved into Afghanistan and Pakistan, and India's just not only their rice, they ConAgra etc. et al. Aren't getting the pesticides into the Indian farmers for the rice, but they've got that wheat, that new wheat fungus, and it's no big thing. I mean, I guess my big overarching issue here is that wheat stem rust has caused famine all through history. I mean, you know, that's a given. I mean, we know about that. But if we don't understand history, we just think we're never going to ever go hungry.
Well, sure. I mean, I'm sure that most of the, and this is not a criticism. It's just if it is a criticism, it's a criticism of our general lack of historical anthropological knowledge, not of anybody in particular. But I am sure that most of the American soldiers who are marching up and down with the targets on their back in Iraq would be absolutely gobsmacked to realize that they are walking through what was at one point in time the most fertile place on planet Earth.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely.
The land between the rivers was green.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, now it's a sandy, dusty place. And it's not because...
It's not only sandy, dusty. It's full of depleted uranium.
Well, there's that, too. But even before the depleted uranium got there, through what we note as modern recorded history, it became very difficult to grow anything there because those were the earliest attempts at humankind manipulating their environment to achieve a specific goal in the form of irrigation was developed there.
Mm-hmm.
All manner of the very first baby steps of agriculture happened there. And what happens when you over irrigate land, and the same thing will happen, for instance, to California someday, where all those places that are artificially irrigated, the soil becomes salinized.
The stories that are coming out of California just break my heart, because I lived in that valley and the almond trees and all the fruit trees, and you go through and every season has a different blooming tree, and I mean we're not even hearing what's going on in California. One more thing about infections that are kind of creeping up on biting us in the butt, if I may, is that I read a report the other day that asthma has been increasing by exponential growth in asthma in the United States, or I don't know about the world, but I know in the U.S., and part of that has been linked to cats. There's something about the cats, there's just something about cats that's causing an increase in asthma, the allergies to the feline allergies.
Feline pet dander is hell. But the other thing you can do, Kate, is you can track the rise in asthma in the American population, especially among American children, with the exponential rise of coal-fired power plants.
Oh, hell yeah. Oh, yeah.
Hand in hand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and something else that this article was talking about was that there's an upsurge in infectious diseases that are carried by pets, other domestic pets besides cats, snakes, frogs, dogs, gerbils, it's an alarming increase in infectious diseases, and some they don't have even any cure for. I mean, you just get infected by your pet from getting it on your face or kissing it or tracking the feces in or not changing the cages or whatever, and they just don't have any cure for them. And we're calling, well, I had the flu last week. I've been down with the flu for 10 days. Don't even know what it is. So anyway, okay, this energy stuff I heard just this morning in my sleep. Caldwell Parish in Louisiana. There's unintended consequences or ramifications that we're not really aware, maybe not everybody's aware of, like, you talked about it last week, I think, about the rural areas being hardest hit by the price of fuel.
Right.
And Caldwell Parish has to shut down their schools one day a week. We talked about that last week in this segment. But because the buses put on almost 1,000 miles a day, and they can't afford the fuel because it's a really poor, poor parish, and so they're cutting back 4 to 4 days. They call one of them a snow day. the one they're off. My mind in my sleep this morning before I even woke up went all the way out like, my God, the parent or the parents had intended for these youngins to be in school 5 days a week until for all their born days. Now, all of a sudden, they're home one day a week. What's that mother going to do with them youngins home one day a week where's she going to get supervision?
Yes, because if she wasn't spending it on gasoline getting to work, now she's going to spend it on the sitter or the daycare, or pray to God that Granny can keep them.
Oh, the kids are home alone, running around. And that county, that parish is a lovely little. Well, it's sparsely populated. There's a little town called Luna, and another one called Eros, and another one called Necessity. Just a little bit south of Monroe, all in the cotton fields that have all been mechanized, and you know, you can tell, you know what, how poverty stricken it is and what the demographics are. But I thought, my God, they're going to only have school 4 days a week. The libraries did concede that they would extend their hours so they would have some places for the kids to be. And
there it is, Louisiana, an oil and natural gas producing state. Mm-hmm. Am I the only one struck by the irony?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Meanwhile, the Republicans are still doing it. I heard Wayne has mentioned this in the past, Kate. I heard some fill-in freak, because the time that I did, what information I did get, I got by turning on the radio while I was in the truck in Morgantown. Some freak filling in for Flush Flimball saying, "If the liberals would only let us build a few refineries, we wouldn't have these high gasoline costs." And you know, I just had to take a minute, Kate, and think, you know, what is the baseline IQ of the average Limbaugh listener that they buy that crap?
I don't know, but I hear it. I heard it this morning at Home Depot when I took one of the elders to town, and the guy sitting next to me, the socially unacceptable corner of the, you know, the social outcast corner having a smoke. He's going on and on and on about the blah, blah, blah. So I thought I would just, you know, that same old crap and China this and the refineries that and the eco tree hugging freak. I thought, so I just started dropping Katrina bombs and I completely dominated the conversation. He got up.
Atta girl.
The other man was so sympathetic, and he was.
Well, but there's a shortcut to that, though, because when they start this refinery crap, you missed the testimony of the five big honchos from the oil company under oath before Congress when they said they don't even want no new refineries. Guess you missed that one, didn't you?
Right.
And then there's the second one. If it's a refinery problem, there'd be gas lines because the supply would be inhibited.
Yeah, right.
But I haven't seen any gas lines. They'll sell you all the $4.10 a gallon gas you want.
There is a really bad side effect from this, from this problem we're having with transportation and high gas. My God, the little village of Maricopa that went from the little Indian village between Phoenix and where I live out in the desert was just a little town, like, you know, 400, 500, 700 people, maybe 1,000 during harvest or cattle slaughtering time or something. 30,000, and most of the houses are empty, and the people that are there have to commute. They moved out here because the taxes are lower, and it's just on this side of the Pinal County line and the city, the little town of Maricopa. Well, I mean, it's just gotten awful. They converted a whole parking lot in front of the sheriff's department into park and ride. Oh, my God. It's wonderful. They've got a couple of three big old buses, you know, the big 50 passenger. They've got some 15-passenger shuttle vans and stuff. So, you know, just bring on that $4 gas. I'd like to see it go up to $5 or $6, but not for people in the rural area, you know. That's the issue. But I was just tickled to death to see that park and ride in Maricopa. Never saw it happen. So,
it's the classic American example. We will not do anything voluntarily.
No.
We will do it when it is rammed down our throat by necessity. You know, necessity is a mother.
The same could be said for the people who are losing power in the White House and the executive branch of the government. They will not go. So I'm back to that. There ain't going to be no election somehow or other. I don't know. Anyway, that's not my fluff piece for the end. My little kicker is not only all of the bugs and the microbes and the infestation and the diseases that are resistant to medication and but this morning I realized after working in the library, I remembered the story about dust mites that are eating the Library of Congress.
Yeah, I've seen something about it, yeah.
They have many, many, many people on staff trying to digitize the information because there's so many millions of documents. And the dust mites are just eating up the Library of Congress. And then I'll leave you with this. And then when they get everything digitized, then we get a virus in the computer and it eats that too. Oh, well.
Every time.
It's a wonderful world. And none of this stuff matters because the bugs are going to win, huh?
They always do.
I'm glad you're back.
Oh, I'm glad to be back. I'm sorry it was such a weird little week. I hate having things like that happen, but I had a wonderful trip with Ferg.
I'm glad you did. But when we get reruns, and I just want to mention to people, I bet you've all been stimulated and people were talking all that big stuff. Well, like I said, half of my stimulus check to the horn. I wonder how many people have.
Well, that would be none because the website's down and all the PayPal buttons are crippled.
There is a freaking mailing address. You know, we do have snail mail these days.
But it's not on the website because the website's down.
The pink envelope. Well, God.
1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318.
Yes, yes.
1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, Beckley, B-E-C-K-L-E-Y, W-V 2580-1.
We do have snail mail because that's how the pink envelopes get to you and Wayne.
Yes.
They come in snail mail. They don't come on no freaking PayPal or in the email. There's still snail mail, folks, so you can just go for it. Anyway, I'm just out of here. I've probably ranted on enough and talked way too long. I don't like talking this long. I want to hear other people.
Yeah, but you're so doggone engaging, and, you know, we have that unique ability to just sort of wander around. I despise linear conversation.
You know how freaking boring it is when people are wandering around? Because we were rerun. I had to hear my thing last week.
It is not boring. Stop that.
I had to hear that hour that we were on last twice. I mean, I just had
okay,
to
it's boring after it's boring on the third pass, but it's great the first time through.
Oh, is that okay? Then I'll never listen to a rerun again.
No, but along those lines, and I will let you go, but along those lines, one of the people who presented to us parents during the seminar was talking about West Virginia and country people in general, and she said, we are great storytellers.
Oh, I'm a storyteller, yes.
And she said, we can engage you for hours on end with our storytelling abilities, and we pass that along to our kids. But then they get to college, and they run up against all these people in university and college situations who aren't from around here, as we like to say. You ain't from around here, are you?
Right.
And they want everything nice and linear. And sometimes they want it mathematical.
God, I can't even spell linear. That's for the L, right?
Yeah, right. And she said, you know, that's where we've dropped the ball. We've got the storytelling and the communicating down pat. Not so good with the straight up mathematical type stuff. So this was the part of the lecture where it was like, you know, I don't know, I would have queued up, to teach your children well or something like that. And she was like, make them take the math class. When they say they want to take wood shop instead, you say no, you're taking trig.
Uh huh. Uh huh.
And
spelled with a T, right?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, stop
well,
it.
When I'm engaging in a conversation with somebody and I get from there, I get storytelling mode and I can see I'm kind of losing them. I say, wait a minute. You don't know me very well. If you just wait long enough, I'll get around to the point. And they go, oh, okay.
But there's more learning. There is more learning to be done in non-linear. Communication,
yeah.
But you have to be conversant with the method in order to get it.
Because you got to shift the pitch to fit the audience. Yeah, that's for dang sure. Yeah.
So.
I wanted to know if you, since I have to unplug my phone to call in, when you were doing the heroes, did you mention Nanette in that your list of the heroes?
No, I said I mentioned three, but yeah, Nanette is one of them too.
Yeah.
Everybody who pours their time, their heart, their energy, and their soul into Coal River Mountain Watch. Mm-hmm. But you know what? Bless his heart, Nick Ray Hall would as soon drop dead as mention any of their names.
Yeah, I know.
Because they're not heroes to Nick Ray Hall. They're problems.
Right. Mm-hmm. Because
they're interfering with his ability to get massive donations from the coal companies.
Yeah, right. I was mentioning this morning to one of my elders that, you know, I have a tremendous amount of experience with what some spiritual attitudes call karmic debt, or commonly known as what goes around comes around. I've been on this planet long enough that sometimes my goes around comes around happens in 15 minutes. No, sometimes like 15 hours, days. Sometimes then I think, oh, maybe I got it. Or when something really comes around and slaps me upside the head, I have to look back and think, what was it that brought this? Oh, my God, that was it. Well, I'm starting to have this really uncomfortable feeling for the people who are causing, like Bear Stearns people that got busted. 400 people are going to be in Arizona that are getting busted for the housing thing. The president, how does he go with 11% approval rating or 98% disapproval? How do they get up in the morning facing the planet one more day without being totally psychopathic or sociopathic or whatever?
Because they are in the first place.
Feel really bad for them because when it comes around on them, it's going to be so big.
It's been coming around, just as an example, it's been coming around on George Bush all his miserable life, okay?
I know.
But he's a sociopath.
Well.
All right, so he doesn't see the connection. Where you can pick it up in 15 minutes or 15 days or 15 hours or 15 years, he's never gotten it. He never understood that the reason that our Busto energy went into the dirt was because he was an evil moron. It was somebody else's fault, and he deserved it when he started Harkin Energy and the Bin Laden family invested in it. Okay,
right.
He deserved that. It's all on the rights end of the spectrum, and never on the duty end of the spectrum for somebody like a Bush. And the same level of sociopathy applies to the CEO of Bear Stearns. He deserved to have the American taxpayers write him a welfare check because he's him.
I had a professor
once who always said that. He noticed that in his class, whenever somebody got a good grade, they said, I got an A. But if they got a bad grade, they said, that son of a bitch gave me a D.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The good was always earned. The bad was always somewhere else. And,
yeah.
You know, Kennedy said the same thing after the Bay of Pigs. He said, success has 1,000 fathers, but failure is an orphan.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's that same level, magnified, exponentialized a million times over when you're dealing with these right wing thugs that have been sucking the life out of America like aphids sucking juice out of a rose.
Oh, back to the bugs. That's the back to the bugs. Yes, you brought it all around. You're so slick.
I'm a professional. Don't try this at home.
Don't mess with the DJ. The DJ got that music down. The bugs and the coal people. Well, just in closing with that karma thing, I just think that on a more of a universal thing, I just catch myself feeling a lot of compassion or something, fear, not fear, but a lot of compassion for those people who have wrought so much havoc and
well, that goes to show that you're a very well evolved spirit, because I got none. If I saw the president of the CEO of Bear Stearns crawling through the streets in rags, I would first, you know, hey, who are you? And they, I used to be the CEO of Bear Stearns. I'd kick him in the ribs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Because he earned that, you know, that trip to the gutter that you feel compassion for.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you believe in karmic debt. He has earned it.
Okay.
Whatever. I mean, no. I'm not trying to be a horse's ass, but I mean, hasn't he? Is it not? Is all of that not earned?
I didn't say it wasn't earned, and I didn't say that I'm some kind of freaking enlightened saint either. Because you are. I have to work on almost a daily basis. Even if that means running 6 miles to Maniac out of Slash Dance to rein in my rage, because.
Yeah, but I mean, do you think the Buddha just sat under the bow tree reading tea leaves?
I don't know what Buddha did, but I know what I'd do.
Jesus wandered around in the desert with 12 idiots to the point that he had to engage in sarcasm in a time and a land where sarcasm was not well received.
Oh, hell, I can do that.
You know, they're looking at him going, Master, when you ascend to the kingdom of heaven, where do I sit? And with perfect, beautiful Jewish humor, he turns to them and says, you all get a crown, all right? And every last one of you are going to sit on my right hand. You and you and you, all of you, at the same time on my right hand with a crown. Are you happy?
With the crown, as long as it has rhinestones in it.
And all the literalists look at that and go, how about that? The saints are going to sit at his right hand and, ho, glory, get a crown. No! You missed it again!
Yeah. Oh, God.
Strike three! Standing there, not even swinging.
The caribou. I have been to the Alaska Pipeline, and the caribou do hang around the pipeline when it's cold in the wintertime, because that pipeline, I've been up there in the wintertime and in the summertime on the pipeline. Wonderful, because even though it's insulated about 3, 4, 5, 6 feet thick, it's just nice and warm. And so the caribou do kind of hang around under the pipeline. So she wasn't far off, but it just sounds funny to somebody.
Well, no, they do that, but there's more. But it's a case of right wingers picking and choosing what they like. So, you know, this breed of caribou does that, but then they ignore the rest of the environmental biology, like the fact that while that caribou species has gone up, another breed called the porcupine caribou is hanging on by a thread for the, mm-hmm. you know, because of the pipeline.
And because, you know, they don't wander around much where it leaks and where it's been leaking and the gauges aren't picking it up down on the control board or the control board operator. And Valdez isn't picking up a minuscule drop in the pressure. They just look at it and go, oh, yeah, right. So, you know, in the meantime.
And then the next generation of caribou were born with, like, little caribou legs growing out of their heads. Because they've also documented the fact that birth rates are down. But, you know, right-wingers and Republicans and profiteers, that's what they are at the end of the day. They're just profiteers, cannot be bothered with that kind of information. And you know how I am with, and I know you wanted to get gone a long time ago, and we'll just finish up real quick. You know I'm a Star Trek geek. And I always wonder after that one movie if maybe whoever wrote that was right and, you know, the whales are calling out to the mothership or whatever. Or maybe it's the damn caribou. Or it's the polar bears. Drowning here. You can blow it up now.
It's all of them, and we're not paying attention. And when I talk this way, you roll your eyes and go, oh, God, don't go there again.
No,
I'm not even. We'll talk about the mothership some other week. We are calling, and nobody is listening, and I'm afraid that.
No, everybody's listening. Where's Parliament and Mothership connection when I need it?
So anyway, we've gotten way far afield from my kicker, my little fluff piece, the dust mites are eating the Library of Congress. Over.
Yeah. Roger that. Copy.
How do you read me? About five, bye.
Bye-bye.
I'm out of here. I'm out of here. Ciao for now.
All right. Bye. We always have to give Kate her a little bump out because, I need a break by the time we're... So we'll be back in a couple of minutes. If you're on hold, for God's sake, stay that way. It won't take but a couple of minutes. But just for you, Kate, right here on the Horn, America's Liberal Voice.
I was just a lad of 10. My father said to me, come here and take a lesson from the lovely lemon tree. Don't put your faith in love, my boy, my father said to me. I fear you'll find the love is like the lovely lemon tree. Lemon tree, very pretty, and the lemon flowery sweet. But the fruit of the poor lemon is impossible to eat. Lemon tree, very pretty, and the lemon flowery sweet. But the fruit of the poor lemon is impossible to eat. Beneath the lemon tree one day, my love and I did lie. A girl so sweet that when she smiled, the stars rose in the sky. We passed the summer lost in love beneath the lemon tree. The music of her laughter hid my father's words from me. Lemon tree, very pretty, and the lemon flowery sweet. But the fruit of the poor lemon is impossible. She left without a word. She took away the sun. And in the dark she left behind. I knew what she had done. She left me for another. It's a common tale but true. Said a tale but wiser now. I sing this song for you. Lemon tree, very pretty, and the lemon flowery sweet. But the fruit of the poor lemon is impossible to eat. Lemon tree, very pretty, and the lemon flowery sweet. But the fruit of the poor lemon is impossible to eat. Lemon tree, very pretty, and the lemon flowery sweet. But the fruit of the poor lemon is impossible.
Yeah, that works. That works. Welcome back. Break over. Coffee breaks over, as the saying goes. Back on your heads, or at least me. We'll go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Oh, wow, that was a long wait.
Sorry about that. Conversation radio, brother.
I understand.
What's going on, Joe?
Listen to that damn lemon song.
Well, yeah, but...
There are many lemon trees in Brooklyn, Bob.
I thought there was a... I guess it wasn't a lemon tree that grew in Brooklyn.
You know, it seems... I was listening to Vince and listening to Kate there, and it's like, my God, it's Depression City today. You know, it's all bad news. And I had some more bad news to dump on it, although you probably heard about
it. I'm not trying to be a bummer. That's why we try to inject a giggle into it here and there.
It's hard to, though, because, you know, so much bad crap. The House passed the FISA compromise today, which really isn't a compromise. Feingold said, it was a capitulation.
Yeah, it is. It's an appeasement. It's a capitulation. Yeah.
And, you know, what scares me about this is not so much the specific bill, which is scary enough, because, you know, I'm with AT&T, and I'm certain that they're following, you know, at least in a, subliminal way, what I do on the web. You know, the things I write, the websites I go to and stuff like that. I know they're following that, and that's being kept somewhere so that if somebody wants to take a look at it, if I ever grew dangerous enough to be a threat to these guys in any way, shape, or form, they could find it and, you know, bring it out, just like J. Edgar Hoover used to do, right?
Right.
It's bad enough that these guys are getting immunity from what they were doing is, you know, for doing these illegal things. The precedent is what's even worse. Suppose George Bush called on the CEO of Blackwater and said, you need to send a few goons over to Bob Kincaid's house because we don't like that head-on radio network. We want you to go in there and trash the servers, beat the crap out of Bob and Agnes and whoever you find in there, and, you know, and just leave it at rest so that they don't bother us anymore. Under the terms of this compromise, because Bush authorized that, and the Justice Department, his Justice Department, says it's legal, it would be perfectly all right. There would be nothing you can do about it.
Well, see, and see, that's why Bush is the ultimate manifestation of the Nixon presidency, Joe.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was Nixon who sat there with a straight face and looked David Frost in the eye and said, "Well, David, if the president does it, it's not illegal."
And now we have an
Now we've got it enacted into law.
Sure. And now the extract that is, if the president says you can do it, it's not illegal. So, you know, the analogy is, if you're walking down the street and the cop stops you and says, "Hey, listen, we need you to knock over this liquor store." If the cop tells you to do it, is it illegal?
For you, but not them.
But what I mean is, if they tell you, "Say, hey, listen, we're gonna deputize you because we want to knock over this liquor store because the wife needs an operation, okay? And you're gonna help us out, and it's perfectly all right because we're the cops." And that's basically the authoritarian mindset up there. Well, you know, if the government tells you to do something, and that was one of the...
Well, that goes all the way back to that old experiment that was so shocking back in the day. I can't even remember what the name of it is anymore. But where the one group, the one group was put in a room and they had wires hooked up to them and they were actors and they were faking it.
Yeah, I know that.
And the other group were told, you know,
how far people could push it. Yeah.
and people were willing to fully electrocute people and make them, like, flop on the ground like fish and die and stuff, as long as someone told them, "It's okay, you have the authority."
Oh, sure. Candid camera, you know, and it's not so much authority, but our desire to conform. But they used to do these wonderful little things, and I remember the thing they did in an elevator. And this was back in the days where all men wore hats, okay, early 60s and stuff like that.
Right.
And they had a guy go into an elevator, and there were two people in the elevator, and they were candid cameras people. And as soon as the one guy got in the elevator, the two guys took their hats off. And the other guy would look around, and slowly, most of the time, they'd take their hat off. Or they'd be facing to the right instead of facing the door. And so everybody got to face to the right because that's what everybody else is doing.
We're herd animals. We always have been. From the day we came down out of the lemon tree, we've been herd animals. No, seriously, you know, we like to live in the citrus trees because vitamin C is the one thing the human body doesn't store.
Hmm.
That's why. We lived in citrus trees.
That.
Yeah, we lived
I'll
in citrus trees.
I'll have to go out and plant a lemon tree now. Actually, I can't.
Yeah, that ain't growing in Chicago there, Joe.
I can't have citrus fruits anyway because the acid is too strong for my stomach now.
Well, and see, Trini Lopez was right. Were you listening?
I'm getting to be an old man now. And I was listening to Vince before, just talking about how tough the job situation is. When I try to explain to people how tough it is to find a job these days, they just say, "Oh, you're just being negative. You're just not trying hard enough, blah, 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 blah." You know, and it just gets frustrating to try to explain to these people that it's not a question of just walking into a company and starting work and getting a paycheck. It doesn't work that way.
Well, you're proving my point because, you know, in talking with Vince and in talking with Kate, it's not, I mean, small town America has problems, but you're in Chicago and it's not much different.
And the jobs there are, you know, basically minimum wage. I mean, right now I'm living on unemployment and I'm back on food stamps again, and I hated to do it, but I got no choice. I make $400 a month in unemployment. I get $81 a month in food stamps. Okay. My rent is only $200, thankfully. My total bills, if you count electricity and gas and the phone bill, are roughly $100. So of the $400 I get for unemployment, $300 goes towards rent and bill to keep a room.
Don't spend it all in one place. Hey, I just got a private message from Pastor John Hagee. He's got a message for you, Joe.
Uh-huh.
"We've rewarded laziness and called it welfare. You no longer look to God, you look for a check in the mail. In the Bible says the man that does not work should not eat. I still think that ought to be the law in the United States of America. If you don't want to get up off your blessed assurance and go to work, starve. I don't care. Starve. I don't feel sorry for you. Go to work."
Nice guy, huh?
Yeah, I know. No, there's millions of idiots who believe maybe if they open them out, their mouths long enough, the demons will come out.
All right, no, I think we'd have to waterboard them to get the demons out.
Yeah, Yeah, that had the guy who did I talk to you about the story? Did anybody tell you? Was there an article in Rolling Stone where one of the reporters went undercover to one of these Christian camps to see what went on there?
I think you may have mentioned it. Go ahead.
But basically he went there and it's almost like where they brainwash. It takes, I think, about a week or 2 weeks or something like that, and they keep you awake from like 6 in the morning to like 12 midnight, and most of the time until the very end where you have the big sermon and the big thing where you have to keep your mouth open so the demons can leave.
Yeah.
They keep you in these little talk sessions where you just talk about, all your problems and your difficulties. And this guy, this guy was surrounded by people who talked about their alcoholic parents and things like that. And he couldn't think of anything right off the bat. So what he blurted out, the story he told, was that his father was an alcoholic clown who used to beat him with his large shoes. And it's the most...
And they fell for it. They fell for it.
He would be, caught immediately. But they bought it. And he was saying that once you go through this experience where you go through that big thing and you open your mouth to let the demons out, you'll believe pretty much anything. Who are serious about it. They'll believe pretty much anything they're told. I've had people I know who are intelligent people talk about, oh, we need to go out and drill in Anwar. And I'm like, I want to point out, I say, you idiot. That's a drop in the bucket compared to what we consume on a regular basis. We've worked so hard to build these communities, and especially in small town America, or in suburban America, which is the worst. I mean, small town's small town, okay? But the suburbs are the worst because they intentionally build communities
that don't have any
gas.
Yeah, that don't have any infrastructure in them.
And they don't have any infrastructure. And if you,
I mean, they're zoned that way, Joe. Thou shalt not have a mom and pop grocery on the corner.
Exactly. I mean, look, I got right here where I live in Chicago. I live near North, the corner of California Avenue. Okay? I can go right down the street. There's a little, it's a Spanish-speaking place mostly, a little Surmac market. I can go there. For $2, I can get a 16-ounce thing of Spanish rice that's got meat mixed in it. That's $2. That's a pound. That's not a bad meal. Okay? But I can go there every day. I don't have to get on a car and waste gas. And I used to remember when I was living in Atlanta, and that SOB Neil Bortz would get on the air and talk about MARTA, and say, talk about how, they urinate in the stalls. Well, that's not how Neil Bortz talks, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
They urinate in the elevators, and meanwhile I'm sitting here thinking, I see what goes on Highway 400 every day. I think it's a parking lot going into the city, and in the evening it's a parking lot coming out, and you people are sitting there, one person to a car, I would think about 80 to 90% of the people there, one person to a car, wasting all that gasoline. Now maybe that you thought that was cool when gasoline was 99 cents.
Well, that's our ride as a market.
That's right. And, their idea is to pay more stuff over, and it's like it doesn't work that way. People bitch about the CTA here in Chicago, and it's got its problems. They had a train derail a couple of weeks ago. It's got its problems. But you know what? I don't need a car here. I can walk to places where I need to go. I can walk to the library down the street. I live right across the street from Humboldt Park, a beautiful, beautiful park that they just had a big Puerto Rican festival here over the weekend with lots of big rides and stuff like that. Didn't have enough money to buy anything, but I walked around.
Yeah.
But the point is, I don't need a car to get to these places. And we've built these communities.
And by virtue of not having a car, you are free of the gasoline cost. You're free of the oil changes. You're free of the maintenance. You're free of...
And in Virginia now, in West Virginia,
yeah.
It's like $4.40, $4.50 here.
Yeah.
Cheap gas. Chicago tends to be more expensive than most places in the country.
Yeah, because of the tax structure under... Yeah, a lot of that is in tax. Because
whether it's taxed or not, the thing about it is, I hear people bitching about gas prices, and I just laugh at them. I'm like, what do you think he's going to do? I heard a guy talk about we should drive a truck bomb into Congress until we get the gas. I said, what the hell do you think Congress is going to do? What do you think Congress is going to do? And by the way, George Bush is listening on this thing right now, and his thugs are coming over to get you.
Yeah, and what is Congress going to do? Because George Bush is still necking with the King of Saudi Arabia.
And, the worst news is, what really pisses me off is that Obama just came out in support of the compromise. He said it wasn't perfect, but, you know, we'll take what we can get.
Well, okay, fine. Show me the get part of the taking.
There is none. And it's mostly,
what's the bargain?
It's
honest to God, I asked it at the front end. I asked it at the front end of the program, Joe. I asked it at the front end of the program, Joe. What do we get out of this? Do I get five? Does anybody get like $5 a month off their cell bill? $5 a month off your hard line?
The Bush people have to have something on them, especially Hoyer and then Pelosi and Reid. I have absolutely no idea why they're doing this, but the entire leadership of the Democratic Party has to go. It has to go. All of them. They have to be voted out. I'm hoping Cindy Sheehan wins Nancy Pelosi's seat.
Well, there's no guarantee she's even on the ballot yet.
Yeah, I know. But something's got to happen because we...
105 members of the Democratic majority joined with 188 Republicans to screw the Fourth Amendment. That's slightly less than half because 128 voted against it.
Now, something where it says, you know, we think it's a bad idea to just give anybody guns and we want to pass a law that says maybe we should have some training involved or something like that, you would see all sorts of stuff railing about the Second Amendment and the sacredness of the Second Amendment. The Fourth Amendment, we don't care because, you know, the Republicans are authoritarian times. They're the ones that if Jesus tells you to do it, you got to do it. And I was just remembering the wonderful speech that Obama gave, you know, and in contrast when he's talking about religion, saying, you know, talking about Abraham and Isaac, how God told Abraham to kill Isaac. And, you know, God, of course, stopped it at the last second. But if we were to go out the door and see Abraham and Isaac on a rooftop and Abraham with a knife at him, you'd call the cops. And you'd hope that the Department of Family and Children's Services would take Isaac away from Abraham, because we don't hear God's voice, you know?
Yeah.
And he sees that, and he understands that, and he gives such a wonderful speech about it, and yet he turns around and says, well, you know, living the threat of days and lots of terrorist threats, and the government needs all the tools it has, blah, 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 blah. And it's like, no, you know, the terrorists have won, Bob. The terrorists have won. Somebody pointed out, it's like a judo chop. 9/11 was a judo chop. They took a much larger opponent, and they managed to use its own strength against it.
Yes.
And that's exactly what's happened. This country is finished. It's over with. And I just don't see how we can get stuff back
here. Well, this country, as any manifestation of a constitutional republic, is finished. Yes.
Yes. That's what I'm saying.
But we'll totter on in our imperial way.
Well, it's not going to work that simply anymore. This is not the Roman Empire. We can't just rule by force. Okay? You know, the Roman Empire lasted a lot longer than the Republic did, but it was a different situation. The technology was different. And the rest of the world, especially if McCain gets in, the rest of the world is going to say, you know what, screw you guys. You know, screw you. We've got our own deal going. The European Union now has the largest economy in the world. They are the biggest economy in the world. And you know what? They did it all by raising salaries, increasing taxes, and spending a lot of money on infrastructure and making sure that their CEOs don't make ungodly sums of money compared to their regular working people. And you talk about all these people saying, well, they earn it, they deserve it. You know, that's a bunch of crap as far as I'm concerned. I mean, you know it and I know it. But it's ridiculous to think that somebody earning $150 million a year deserves a bigger tax break than me. Okay? That's ridiculous.
Well, it's ridiculous. Well, at its base level, Joe, somebody owning, and frankly, $150 million is chump change on CEO.
For a big corporation, perhaps, but, you know, that's enough where you can...
There is not anything that a human... At the end of the day, there's not anything that a human being can do, Joe, that's worth $150 million a year.
Bob, I've pretty much limited myself to the fact I've acclimated. That's the right word. I've acclimated myself to the fact that anything that I can do right now is not even worth more than $8 or $9 an hour. There's nothing I can do that is worth $8 or $9. You know, I got turned down for a data entry job at a local factory here, which I thought was a really good company, the Friedman Seating Company. They build a seat. So they're going to be in business for 50, 60 years. You know, and it was a simple data entry position, and I didn't get it. And I'm thinking, are they thinking I'm overqualified? And I tried to explain to them, look, you know, don't look at my resume and think that I'm too good for this job. I just, you know, I need the work. And they're probably saying, what's wrong with this guy? He's so smart and knows all this stuff, and yet he wants a piece of crap job like this. And the fact of the matter is, I'm not smart enough or good enough for the really high-paying jobs, like when I was doing the research for that lawyer person there. He gave up on me because I wasn't doing the job to his satisfaction. Having never really seriously done it, he didn't want to give me a decent chance. And that's just the way it is. And I've pretty much acclimated myself to that. I'm pretty certain I'm just going to be like this for the rest of my life because I don't see it changing. I don't see the country changing enough that it would give someone like me the opportunity. In better days, a guy like me would be a decent middle manager or a foreman at a factory somewhere. You know, maybe not, you know, executive thing, but like the sergeant I was in the military, a good, solid person with good organizing skills, can work well with people, and who knows how to get things done when things need to get done. Okay, maybe not the best person in a crisis situation where everything's falling apart at the same time, but somebody who could think things out and put together a nice, efficient organization. There's no room in this country for a guy like me like that anymore. There's no room for it. You either, you know, and I was saying that maybe my next job, I'll put up a completely lie resume. I'll become the CEO of a company, demand huge amounts of money, run the company into the ground, and take a $500 million severance check. That'll be my next job, Bob.
Yeah, you'll be Homer Simpson designing the, what was the name of that car?
Oh, God, the Homermobile. I know, that's not what they call it, but I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Or better yet, when the one where they were asking employees to improve the plant, and the little kid came up, and he showed this wonderful, you know, miniaturized thing, and Burns was like, yeah, like, whatever. And the kid said, but it's powering this very auditorium. Look, and he turned it down, and the lights went down, and Burns was like, get out of here. The Homer Simpson, and Homer comes out with his, and it was basically the same thing, but he had wings on the cooling towers for air resistance.
Oh, truth is stranger than fiction.
Well, and what was that guy's name? Ed Grimes? He was the guy, he was like, he couldn't believe that Homer was getting away with this guy. Look, was working so hard and, you know, trying to get things done. Here's Homer just goofing off and succeeding, and it drove the poor guy crazy. He couldn't deal with it.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like how I feel.
I don't know. Maybe you need to dumb down your resume, Joe.
I'm sorry?
Maybe you need to dumb down your resume.
I've tried that too, and it works just as badly. I really think,
you know, pick your nose in the interview or something.
I think it's just me. I think I walk in there and people just say, we don't want anything to do with this guy. You know, and I hear guys like you, you know, you're always trying to compliment me, you tell me good things about myself, and that's nice of you, and Agnes says good things, and the Thane of Fascist says nice things, and my friend Tommy, you know, say, but we don't understand how you can, you know, how people are not picking you up for jobs. Yet when I go for an interview, it's all like, see you later. It used to be when I got into an interview, that was it. I had the job clinched. But now it's so much.
Well, remember, you are on the cusp of the people who are covered, among other things, and we had to have a law for this passed. You're on the cusp of the front end of what is referred to as the class that's protected by the Age Discrimination and Employment Act.
Mm.
Okay. Because the employers hate guys in their mid to late 40s. They loathe them.
Yeah.
Not as fast and not as malleable and as dumb. No offense to the younger folks. Okay, not as fast and as malleable. I'll check dumb back out of it.
The young aren't dumb. It's just that they don't understand and they're more.
They work for less. They haven't been around the block a couple of times. Yeah. I mean, you were talking earlier about the Rolling Stone guy going to the religious camp and, you know, what happens to a human being when they're kept at it from 6 a.m. to midnight, or 5 a.m. to midnight. Things happen to your brain, whether it's a religious experience or whether it's boot camp. Boot camp's structured the same way. Guess what? Medical school residencies are the same thing because things happen to your brain, and your brain can be changed by who's ever in charge when they do that to you.
It's the way of the country, Bob. It's the way things are going now.
It's the code of the West.
This apartment I'm renting here, I basically, I'm one of four guys that rent rooms in this apartment. And the guy that just moved in, he's talking about how he gets up at like 6 o'clock in the morning and works till like 10, 11 o'clock at night. And he's proud of this. He's happy with this. He's proud of this. And I'm just like, you know, and I'm sitting here, I don't have enough work. You know, it's hard enough me getting a job and things are getting slimmer and slimmer. And he's working too hard. I mean, there's no there's no in between, it seems. You can't just go out and have a nice job where you can support yourself and just go home and watch some TV and vegetate. You know, or maybe go out with your wife or your girlfriend or something and have a nice dinner every now and then because you're earning enough money to be able to do that.
It's uniquely American.
And, yeah, and we have this, and I would get into this when I was working at DTI. People would be bragging about working through their breaks, and I'm like, are they paying you more money? You know, I mean, what's wrong with you?
Yeah, it reminds me of how my dad would always make the auto dealer take his little, you know, Schmedlik Chrysler Plymouth, you know, the plate that's on the back of wherever you bought it from. When they were doing the prep on the automobile before they'd turn it loose, doing, oh, take that thing off. Huh? Take that thing off.
I'm not giving you free advertising.
Yeah, I didn't see a 5,000 break on the price of this car from me driving around and advertising your car lot. Take the damn thing off.
And people wearing T-shirts for stuff too.
Yeah, but you know, they thought my dad was like a mean guy for saying that. When all in the world he was, and you know, every now I see it and I go, yeah, take that thing off. I went out and scraped at the thing on my truck until I started messing up the paint and then quit. But we don't think about that stuff, you know. And yeah, we walk with that. Well, look, there we are. We can't have a conversation without talking about Idiocracy.
Mm.
You know, all the clothes have logos on them.
I need to watch that movie again just to remind myself of where we're going.
We hit it about once every week and a half.
You really should. I think it ought to be mandatory showing in every classroom in school. This is what we're becoming, ladies and gentlemen. And you know, with Kate talking about, you know, the kids coming home for extra day, you know, there's no money for education. There's plenty of money to get to fat ass CEOs, okay, but no money for education. And you know, we still have schools fighting, wasting time, efforts, and resources to fight this creationism stuff. However, whatever they call it, intelligent design, or whatever they call it. Meanwhile, schools in Europe, schools in China, they're teaching kids, you know, science, math. You know, God is not, you know, God is only important to a certain extent if you have faith. But quite frankly, there is reality. And reality has a nasty way of biting you in the ass. The floodwaters in Iowa, you know, what is it? Something like 80% of the state was under flood conditions.
Yeah.
And the microbes that Kate was talking about, I didn't even know about this. See, this stuff, and even I didn't know about this stuff, okay? And you know what? Nature, they don't care about our ideologies. They don't care about why we think something works.
Nature no, but they will. But nature will.
It always works.
But nature will exploit the idiotic choices we make as a result of our ideologies.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, potatoes with goat genes in them and things like that will be exploited. Wiping out the good critters in order to get at the bad will be exploited. Overuse of antibiotics gets exploited, and you wind up with staph infections. And all these are ideologically, in many cases, driven. You know, we talk about how, you know, scientists don't believe in evolution, blah 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 blah. It strikes me that maybe the scientists who are working for Monsanto might actually believe that fundamentalist garbage, because everything in nature creates an opportunity for something else. And the Monsanto people have, to this day, haven't figured out that when you hybridize the entire world seed supply, you're creating a situation where no seed on Earth may someday grow. And you're back.
You also have when you're replicating things, when you're cloning things and along those lines, there was an article about bananas or something like that. If they're all genetically exactly the same, a disease affects one, it affects all of them. There's no room for mutation there.
Oh, I've got a story somewhere in the stack about some right winger who proved that evolution is a fraud with a banana. And okay. because he said, God created the banana because it perfectly fits the human hand.
Okay.
And as a result, without realizing how ignorant he is, because it perfectly fits the simian hand as well, which we were before we were human. But never mind that either, because the banana has been deliberately monkeyed with over the course of generations to produce that yellow, that green thing that sits on the counter in your grocery store that you have to wait for it to ripen. You know, if you go and you look at, like, organic bananas and bananas from, you know, those weird little small bananas, bananas started out small. You know, nature doesn't generally make huge things because it takes too much energy. It has to be coaxed into it.
Every breed of dog that has ever existed has been made by man.
Yes.
Through breeding practices.
Right, right.
Every single breed of dog.
Look, you know, the progenitor of corn is something called teosinte, and it is not recognizable as corn. It had to be, it took, you know, 10,000 years for Native Americans to do that, the first peoples on these continents, but they did. If you go to Peru tomorrow, you'll find in the market stalls there literally hundreds, if not thousands, of different varieties of potatoes, because that is the seed bed of the spud. And, you know, it took a lot of genetic manipulation to get to the Idaho baker. But these people, it doesn't dawn on them. Because they just see a banana and they say, God made that to fit in my hand.
Well, you know, that's just, when you have a limited way of thinking, I guess that's the only explanation. And that's basically what intelligent design is. We're too stupid to figure this out, so we're just going to say God did it.
Yeah.
That funny political cartoon where they had a formula, and in the middle of the formula it just wrote, and here a miracle occurs. And the other scientist said, I think you need to work on that a little bit more.
Yeah, no kidding. I'm going to quit leaving home because I get my senses assaulted every time I leave here. I'm up in Morgantown yesterday, driving around. First I hear the Flush Flimball fill-in guy arguing that if we'd only build more refineries, the price of gas would go down, which, you know, just made me almost bend the steering wheel beating on it. And then I pull up in traffic and I took a picture. I pull up behind this pickup truck that's got, like, construction gear and a toolbox in the back, and it's a relatively new, decent-looking truck, and it's got a bumper sticker on the back, Joe, and it's white letters on a black background, and it says, No Bitch, No Bama, 08.
Yeah. Yep.
But he's gonna go home tonight, Joe, and he's gonna say, God, that 410 a gallon gas is a killing me. And his wife's gonna put
where we want it. You know, maybe we ought to drill at his house.
Yeah, well, you know,
we think there's some oil underneath your house.
No, we'll build the refinery at your house.
Yeah.
You know, but his wife's gonna put a bowl of beans and a piece of cornbread in front of him. He's going, where's my steak?
You know what I came
across? Well, we can't afford steak.
A while ago was it on YouTube? It was from the Jimmy Carter National Archives. That Jimmy Carter gave about energy about 30-something years ago. And he was basically saying, look, you know, it doesn't look like it now, but we're going to have some serious problems in the future if we don't take action now to start reducing the amount of gas that we use and things like that. You know, and then people forget the 55-mile-an-hour limit. It wasn't
safety.
For safety. Safety was a byproduct of it. It was created to say, hey, listen, if you slow down, you use less gasoline. And people laughed at Jimmy Carter for that. People still laugh at Jimmy Carter. Oh, what a wussy. What a little weenie. You know? And they're still doing stuff like that. You know, all Democrats are wimps and wussies and stuff like that. And the Republicans are manly men. You know,
yeah, I know.
Got a barbecue going. We're going to go. That's the guy we want to lead the country.
Yeah, but just remember.
Can't be president.
Just remember, Joe, when that guy sits down and says, where's my steak? And the wife says, well, honey, it was $9 a pound and we can't afford it. He won't think about what he has done with, you know, with his political philosophy and his no bitch, no bama 08 sticker. He'll think, dang, it's them liberals' fault.
Them liberals. Them liberals.
Yep. So. I know. I know. Hey, Joe, I got to roll on, brother. I got to.
Katie was much more fun to talk to. You got a lot more giggles out of it. I think I do find ways of having a good time, even though I am blessed with wonderful poverty here. I guess I'm gonna be one of those people inheriting the kingdom because I got nothing. But I do manage to have a good time in between my job searches. I go to the park, I go to the library. Thank God there are enough liberal stuff here, because you know something, if there was no liberals, there would be no public parks. Chicago has more public parks, I think, than any city of its kind.
If there were no liberals, Joe, Chicago would be Dallas.
Yeah, exactly. By the way, talking about energy uses, I read a story about where in Dallas, in some of the office buildings, the air conditioning is so cold that people in the summer bring space heaters to their offices. And not so, so they're wasting a ton of energy on the air conditioning, and then they're turning around and wasting more energy to heat the place up. Or to heat up their feet, because, and I've been to places where it's air conditioned so cold, but you feel like you got to put on a sweater.
I love
that energy waste.
I'm guilty. I love that, but, you know.
You know, that's fine maybe for your house there in West Virginia, but for a 50, 60 story office building, you know what kind of energy that takes?
Yes.
Like
yes,
now?
I do. And you know what? They could air condition the apartment build, the office buildings, to 55 degrees if they wanted to, with very little effort if we'd get serious about solar and geothermal. And nobody'd have to blow up. No mountains would have to go away. No one would have to die in the Middle East. And children wouldn't have to get asthma.
Stupid. I mean, look, I don't have a problem with anybody making a profit. You know, there's nothing wrong with that. But their problem is not so much that they want to make a profit, but that they're control freaks. They're so stupid, they don't realize, you know, 30 years ago they said, you know, President Carter may be a weenie, but maybe he's got a point. Maybe we ought to start diversifying and start looking for other resources because, you know, maybe this stuff isn't going to last forever. Maybe it will, maybe it won't. But, you know, if we start working on things, then maybe 30 or 40 years from now, we'll still be making a bundle and nobody will be at our throats. Now they're making a bundle, and people eventually, because there's a lot of people who do recognize that it's big oil that's causing these problems, and not the liberals. There are a lot of people who think that, and eventually, you piss off enough people, you wind up hanging from a tree. Okay? It happened to Mussolini. It happened to Louis XVI. It can happen. Well, Louis got his head cut off, and Mussolini was hung by his feet. It happened to Ceausescu. He was a left-wing guy that people got fed up. You think that's not going to happen? You think people in this country eventually are not going to get pissed off?
It's so far in the future that the United States will not be recognizable as the United States when it does happen.
No, and I agree with you. But eventually, it's going to happen sooner. And how is that good for anybody? What do I keep saying about conservatives? What is the third rule about conservatives? The world ends when they die. They just don't care. What they're doing in rape and pillages, and they die, you know, but other people worry about that. History will be dead. Is that what George Bush said? Something like that?
Yeah, by the time the history's written, we'll be dead.
We'll be dead.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep. Well, I'm going to roll along here. Hang in, brother.
I will do that.
And
I'm sorry to see the website. I actually tried to get in.
Oh, no. The website's a disaster right now, but John's doing everything in his power to bring it back.
More power to him. Listen, Bob, take care. Say hi to everybody out there for me, and all the people in the chat room I'm saying hi to. And I'm still here. I may be, you know, fighting the cockroaches for scraps, but I'm still here.
Well, I'll tell you what. Look, all we can do is tough it out. A lot of people in the same shape, Joe.
A lot of people are worse. At least I've got a roof over my head.
There is that. We'll talk to you soon, brother. Have as good a weekend as you can.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Bye. Our buddy Joe Vecchio. And let's... roll along and see what's happening here. Hi, who have I got?
Good evening, Bob.
Hey, David, what's up?
Yeah, I just wanted to mention about the FISA thing and the telecommunications immunity and stuff like that. It occurs to me that I have a new word that we don't call them political leaders. We have to downgrade them now, Bob.
Oh, I never call them leaders.
Well, we can't call them politicians now. That's being too fair to them. We can't call them officials. I have the perfect words.
Lay it on me.
Here it is. Ideologue custodian.
Ideological custodians.
Yes. Because if we
corporate
them,
corporate custodians?
That could work too. But I think the ideological works for the Democrats and Republicans, because I want them to realize that you're not a leader and you're not acting like an official, so at least you can do is clean up the toilet in the halls of democracy.
Well, I got a list here of 105 people that I damn sure don't recognize as being Democrats.
Well, I've never recognized pretty much any of these people as Democrats. And, you know, and then I looked at it, and my conservative friend told me when we were talking about this, and he said, what were they doing beforehand? Were they protecting the rights of wiretapping and surveillance? And I said, you know what? You're probably not right, and you're probably right. And I was like, and then he's like, whose fault is that? And I have to go back to, again, Bob, it is. It's the American people. It's a slippery slope. We let it happen. We should, during the Clinton years, during the Bush years, you know, heck, every year that they brought up the wiretapping and those little tiny paragraphs, someone should have blew a whistle and said, I don't think so, and give them a pimp slap right across the face.
Well, but you can also do a little bit of comparative politicology if you want to, David, on this. If Bill Clinton had brought up something like this during his administration with a Republican Congress having to deal, they would have added articles to the articles of impeachment. Okay, I mean, wait, please. And just on a mathematical basis, when I think about the shoe leather that got worn out in 2006 to create a Democratic majority in the Congress, when I think about the heart and soul that went into creating this Democratic majority, when I think about the begging and the pleading and the earnest remonstration with people to try to create a Democratic majority, and then I look at this damn bill, David, and I see that it is a bill that was passed not by the Democratic majority, but by 105 Democrats in company with 188 Republicans. This isn't a Democratic bill. 128 Democrats and one Republican voted against it. But 188 Republicans and 105 so-called Democrats created and passed this bill. In other words, Nancy Pelosi cannot even control her own Congress.
It's an illness, Bob, and this country has not resisted this illness. They've just got sicker and sicker, and this is what we're being dealt with. And the only thing that I can say to people who keep pointing the accusing finger, I'm going to say this. Put the mirror up to the American population, all of us, every single one of us, because this is what we sowed right here. This is every single convenience that we've gotten, Bob, from the corporations, every single logo that we've had, this is what it's come down to. Eventually, you know, Bob, we were going to pay the price, and here we are paying the price over and over and over. And I guess that speaks to a new equation that convenience will eventually equal inconvenience, creatures of convenience. So it may have taken some time, but here it is. And we certainly are learning a powerful lesson, and I would like to close with this. It's a short little paragraph, and it's called Parables of a Trapeze Artist. And it's by, I don't know if you know this, but it's been passed around over and over. It's by Dinan Perry.
Okay.
Sometimes I feel that my life is a series of trapeze swings. I'm either hanging onto a trapeze bar, swinging along, or I'm hurtling across space in between bars. Most of the time, I hang on for dear life to my trapeze bar of the moment. It carries me along in a certain steady rate of swing, and I have the feeling that I'm in control of my life. I know most of the right questions and even some of the answers, but every once in a while, I'm merrily swinging along. I look out ahead of me into the distance. What do I see? I see another trapeze bar swinging toward me. It is empty, but I know that this other bar has my name on it. It is my next step, my growth, my aliveness, coming to get me. I know that for me to grow, I must release my grip on this present, well-known bar and move to the next one. Each time it happens to me, I hope and pray that I won't have to grab a new one. But I know that eventually I must totally release my old bar, and for some moment in time, I must hurtle across space before I can grab the new bar. each time I am filled with terror. It doesn't matter that in all my previous hurdles across the void of unknowing, I have always made it. I am each time afraid that I will miss, that I will be crushed on unseen rocks below, but I do it anyway. Perhaps this is the essence of what the mystics call the faith experience. No guarantees, no net, no insurance, Polly. But you do it anyway. Somehow, to keep hanging on to that old bar is no longer an alternative. And so for an eternity that can last a microsecond or a thousand lifetimes, I soar across the dark void of the past. The past is gone. The future is not here yet. It's called transition. I have come to believe that this transition is the only place.
David?
Between places. Sure, the old trapeze bar was real, and then new ones coming toward me. I hope that's real, too. But the void in between, that's just a scary, confusing, disoriented nowhere that must be gotten through as fast and as unconsciously as possible. What a waste. I have a sneaking suspicion that the transition zone is the only real thing, and the bars are illusions we dream up to avoid the void. Whether or not my hunch is true, it remains that the transitions in our life are incredibly rich places. They should be honored, even savored. Yes, with all the pain and fear and feelings of being out of control that can accompany transitions, they are still the most alive, most growth-filled, passionate, expansive moments in our lives. It can be terrifying. It can also be enlightening in the true sense of the word. Hurtling through the void, we just may learn to fly.
Amen to that. Thank you, David, and a good weekend
right,
to you.
All right, Bob, later.
All right, see ya. Our pop culture correspondent, David from Maine. And rolling onward. Okay. Let's see. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob. It's Richard.
Hey, Richard.
Outside of Richmond, California.
Yes.
And, gee, I was concerned about you.
How so?
Are you okay?
Oh, I got pretty bad sick. It was. I got pretty bad sick. It was scary.
What happened?
Gut troubles. Things involving my abdominal region that involve gallbladder, pancreas, large intestine, small intestine, kidneys. A real party.
So where are you at with it now?
I'm starving to death. No, I'm kidding.
Still, huh?
No, well, I'm still supposed to be like zero fat, you know, no meat, very little, if all, at all, you know, clear liquids, just trying to keep my energy up and watch the weight come off and give my insides a chance to heal.
And did they find nasty little things in your gallbladder?
No, actually, they said my gallbladder's happy and healthy, but I've also read that those scans that I had done can not necessarily be indicative of perfect health.
Yeah. Well, good luck with it all.
Well, thank you. I do appreciate it.
I hope to hear that you're back being a happy foodie again.
I'm still a foodie. I'm an observer foodie. I think my days of cream sauces and big old fatty pulled pork barbecue sandwiches are kind of over. But it's a trade I'm with. You know, if I got to make that trade to see. You know, my kids grow up and maybe more grandkids and stuff like that. It's a trade I'm willing to make.
Right.
I joke about starving and stuff, but I'm not really. What I'm doing is profoundly modifying my dietary habits. And so
I'm discovering the joys of tofu, actually.
Well, at some point I'll be going in that direction too. Right now we've just got to get me off the Fat Jones.
And
a lot of it, you know, frankly, a lot of it has to do with what I do here, because it became very easy to just get a little box of little, you know, have a little bag of chocolate and a jar of cheese dip and some Doritos or Fritos or something and just sit here and graze while I work. And that can't happen anymore. And there's no more mainlining the Tostitos cheese dip. That's over.
So we're talking about, cholesterol and stuff like that.
Yeah, because what I found out after the fact, of course, is that cholesterol and triglycerides burn up your pancreas. Ow.
Are we still connected?
We are. That kind of hurt, but I'll be okay.
Okay, I'm sorry. I dropped the cordless phone.
I'm modifying. You know, and the funny thing is, it hasn't been that profound. And maybe if I learn that I can change my diet and change all of that stuff and maybe do some lifestyle changes, the next thing I'll find out is I can quit smoking. And then I won't have any vices left, and I'll have to turn into a televangelist. No, I can't be a televangelist.
You got it.
Or a yogi or something.
You got to make your new cuisine so, interesting and exciting that you don't miss the old stuff.
Yeah, I've got a copy of the Moosewood Cookbook, and I've been browsing through it trying to get excited about it. I'm not there yet, Richard.
Yeah. Well, there have been a few shows that haven't made it into the archive lately, including you, and I was concerned.
Well, I wasn't here yesterday and the day before, and then Monday was a technological abortion, so it's been a weird week. So
got it.
Yeah, so there's no archives of that.
Well, I'm glad you're still alive. My best wishes otherwise. And, of course, I have a topic.
Yes.
A few of your callers have mentioned rail transit, the joys of streetcars and things like that.
Yeah.
And I remember that. I mean, I grew up in New York City and in Brooklyn, at sort of the other side of Brooklyn than Joe grew up in. Brooklyn's a big place.
I've heard that.
Yeah. Got the most people, and it was an independent city until 1900, not part of New York. So I used to go to school on a streetcar. And right above the streetcar was an L. So I could take the L, which went down into the subway, or I could go to school in the streetcar. And it was very nice to have those alternatives. The streetcar came out. There are, a lot of people think that streetcars were ripped out of a lot of American cities due to the connivance between General Motors and, Firestone. They set up a corporation that bought up local transit lines, mostly streetcars, and converted them to buses. Now, I don't know what the truth is. There's history, and I believe there was a court case involved, and, there's truth and there's fiction and, maybe some of each. So.
Well, never make the mistake of assuming that business will not engage in nefarious practices to increase its profit. Because it's worth remembering, I've said it a dozen times here, I'll say it again, there is no duty on the part of any corporate officer or any corporate board of directors to do anything except make profit. You can't sue a board of directors for getting the silver settings wrong. You can't sue a board of directors for helping people to die in Darfur or anywhere else. You can, however, sue a corporation for not doing everything humanly possible to make another buck. The only fiduciary duty held by a corporate officer is to make a buck.
Yeah, I believe that.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, that's why when I see that some university has a course called corporate ethics, I just sort of snicker up my sleeve. Yeah, that's going to be a 15-minute class.
It's a contradiction in terms.
Yeah, because there are none. It is dog-eat-dog the way that we have defined it in America.
Well,
profit and profit only.
In New York City, back to the streetcars, the city itself ran all the transportation in Brooklyn, with the exception of, a couple of little corners of the borough, which had private bus lines. But they ran the streetcar system, and when I was a kid going, taking it to school, there were three streetcar lines left in Brooklyn, and they were pretty pleasant. And then they took them out, and the final streetcar in the city was a strange little operation that ran over the Queensboro Bridge. That's called the 59th Street Bridge, by the way. same as a...
There was a song about that.
Yeah.
Makes me feel groovy just thinking about it.
In the middle of that bridge is an island. And there is or was an enormous elevator that ran up from the island to the bridge. So there was a streetcar that ran over the bridge and stopped in the middle. And people could get on and off the elevator. And it was kind of unique. It ran on along the edges of the bridge. And didn't go very far. Other than that, it went a short distance at each end of the bridge. It was run by a private company, but the issue of that in the old days the transit companies tended to lose money. It's as simple as that. There are interurban railroads that were lightly built lines that went between cities. There were a few in West Virginia, as a matter of fact, but I don't think near you.
But I know what you're talking about. Yeah, there was one that ran through Spencer and Ripley and stuff. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and they would run through the downtowns of, the cities and towns that they went through. What helped to kill off cars was the fact that in most municipalities, the streetcar company was charged with maintaining the street itself. So they had to water the streets. They had to sweep the snow off the streets where the tracks were, as well as take up the expense of maintaining their tracks. And, of course, in the first case, for building the tracks, which meant ripping up the street. So there was a lot of expense involved.
Right.
And there was expense in maintenance. You had to maintain the overhead wires. You had to run electrical substations, which converted the electricity from commercial power down to the DC that the trolley cars used. So it, in a lot of ways, buses looked advantageous. You see, because these expenses weren't there.
Yeah. And
here, where I live...
Richard, does this tell you, from your vantage point, that the likelihood of getting some similar level, even if gasoline goes to $10 or $15 a gallon, that it can't come back or won't come back because there's always going to be some profiteer looking to destroy it?
It's very tricky. People in general, businesses don't really want to go into the transit business for good reason, because it's silly at it, I mean, that's why the city of New York wound up running the subways, is because the RLT and the BMT, which were private companies, pretty much threw in the towel. You can't charge people what it costs. It's got to be subsidized from taxes. And I think that's the bottom line to get anything.
Because it is not, and I think if I read you right, Richard, what you're saying is it is not a profitable business. It is not It is not a business that should be based on, what we were discussing a few minutes ago. It is not a business that can be successfully run for profit. It can be successfully run. It can be successfully run on a not-for-profit or on a public service basis, because it is possible to do it in such a way that you can cover costs, and by costs, I mean employment costs, labor costs, materials costs, fuel costs, things like that, but that the margins are so narrow, you cannot do it for profit.
Not only is the margin so narrow, there's no margin. I mean, it's a loss, period. Your typical transit system, let's say, the customer gets on and pays $1 for a ride, it costs them $2 to carry the person. You stop and think about it. You pay the driver. You got to maintain the bus. You got to buy the bus.
Well, there is an uphill climb, and I think what you point to, Richard, is the fact that it's getting some level of mass transportation on a national level is going to require an act of national will. You know, I saw that bill go through and Congressman Ray Hall heralded $15 billion for the next 5 years of Amtrak. $3 billion a year to run a national passenger rail service. That's ludicrous. It's ludicrous, Richard. It's ludicrous.
Amtrak is going to lose a fortune the way it's set up right now. The reason is, let's take a train that goes by near you. Well, it runs every 2 days, right?
No, heck no. Wednesdays and Sundays.
Are you saying 2 days a week?
Yeah.
Wow. I didn't know it was. And by the way,
And bear in mind, those 2 days a week go all the way to, Washington, D.C. and up the Eastern Corridor and as far west as Chicago.
Right. Yeah, I know the route. It's a classic route, by the way, but because it hardly ever runs at all, and, of course, a lot of its distance is running, it's running in the middle of the night when nobody wants to get on or off. And they're maintaining stations for it. You see all that money going down the drain. And now take that route, again, that goes through Prince, right?
Yeah.
That route, when I was a kid, had through trains on it, spaced around the clock. Each one of those trains had sleeping cars. Each one of those trains had a diner car on it.
It wasn't 4 years ago that route came nigh to dying.
It always comes to near to death. I mean, they go through this.
Well, you're right, Richard. The whole Amtrak thing is constantly on life support.
Well,
and that's
your train. I forget, what are they calling it now, the Cardinal?
Yeah, it's the Cardinal.
Yeah, because that's one of the first, one to look to track all the time, is your train.
Yeah, because there's still a little bit of sexy to the city of New Orleans and the Southwest Flyer and the,
there used to be three trains a day and, you know, you could drop off and visit somebody and then catch the next train and continue your journey. You know, that's the way a lot of the country was. And there even was a local as well. So when you get density that way, I mean density of service, then people are going to flock to it, you know? You follow what I'm saying?
Yes, I do.
It makes it practical. And if you have local connections, in other words, local buses and local streetcars that with those trains, now you can really get people out of their cars because they don't need them.
But that's the problem, though, is working out that end, Richard, because that works well in an urban situation where it stops every other street corner or whatever.
Exactly.
But it doesn't work so well in the sprawl that we have either intentionally or unintentionally created, the suburbs that Joe was talking about, you know, where they deliberately zone away businesses, not so much. Hey, Richard, I've got a bunch more blinking, but I'm glad you called in, and it's well worth thinking about. The question is whether we're ever going to get serious enough to deal with this. You know,
Los Angeles did.
LA, have they? I mean, last I checked, a lot of the interstates are still parking lots.
No, they are, but they've gotten serious about mass transit. They've put in a few light rail lines, and if they can do it.
and see, that's one of those, you know, we pride ourselves on American know-how. You know what? If we really wanted to get serious about it, American know-how could at least come up with the meaningful rail that works as well as, say, you know, Japan's or Europe's.
Well, I'll talk about that some other time. You've got some blinking people right now, and I'll call back and talk about that.
Okay, sounds good. You have a wonderful weekend, Richard. Thanks for checking in.
Okay, you too. Bye.
Talk to you soon. Bye. Our pal Richard from up in Richmond, California. And let's see. Here we go. Hi, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, it's Preston.
Oh, hey, Preston, how are you?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you?
I'm getting better, I think.
Good.
I am wore out. I got walked all over Morgantown, and my legs are sore. I'm living proof that I need to get a little more active.
Well, you said you were walking all over Morgantown?
Yeah. Yeah. They bust us from point to point, but then we got out and hiked a good bit.
Okay. This is for your
It was for the seminar I took my son to.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. Do you mind what that was on?
Oh, yeah. It was to encourage middle schoolers to consider health sciences careers.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
So they got to see the medical school and the dental school and the school of pharmacy, and Ferg got to make some ointment at the school of pharmacy. He was terribly, terribly excited. And we learned about funding some of it. The parents.
Okay. I have a DVD that you might be interested in, your son, on health issues and careers in health. It's about the Cuban medical system and all those tens of thousands of doctors they have as healthcare ambassadors around the world, lots of places in Africa. And just like 3 or 4 years ago, they opened a school, maybe more, it was years ago, where people from around the world could go and get free medical training. And the first graduating class included a couple dozen people from the United States, actually, some from Native American reservations and others from just poor.
And they haven't been blacklisted by the State Department or anything?
Amazingly, they probably.
Or did they set it up outside the territorial confines of Cuba?
No, it's definitely in Cuba. It's in Havana, and it's an amazing place. Not only is it very, professional, just excellent in their field, but they also integrate cultural aspects, dance, music, and art. And I'm sure they're on some blacklist. And this FISA surveillance thing. I mean, I know it's a problem, but part of me is like, this has been going on all along. I just kind of assumed, we're all being surveilled and all that kind of stuff. The question is, do we let it intimidate us away from activism? There's a part of me that wants them looking at my papers and my books. Maybe it'll change some minds.
I can always count on you, Preston, to take the Rubik's Cube and give it a twist, because most of us look at it and say, Joe said it a little bit earlier. He said, if they want to, they can say, go rough up the Kincaids and make sure that they don't bother us anymore. But what you say is very true. Let them hear the discord and the discontent out here, and let them see what they can do about it. By God, it takes a brave man to say something like that.
Yeah.
I applaud you.
Thank you. And I applaud your efforts. And, I'm glad people are bringing up this topic. It's kind of taboo. It's kind of spooky. And, but I do think we need to look at it. And because I think it neutralizes a lot of people. People are afraid to bring it up because they're afraid of being labeled paranoid or whatever.
Paranoia is the unreasonable fear that people are out to get you. Emphasis on the word unreasonable.
Right.
There's a great story out here. I don't know if you've seen it today, but what you're talking about just plays right into it. There's a guy in Minnesota who is none too happy today, Preston. Did you see this?
No.
He lives in Lakeville, Minnesota, and he was sound asleep at 3 a.m. when he was awakened, not by phone, mind you, but he was awakened by being, sort of shaken awake. Hey, buddy. Hey. By a couple of cops who woke him at 3 o'clock in the morning to tell him that his door was unlocked.
Mm.
Now, apparently the police there in Lakeville, Minnesota, have a policy of leaving notices on unlocked doors, which means that the cops are going door to door. Preston, we used to have this thing in America where we said, this was a safe community. Nobody locked their doors at night. And now, apparently, in the police state, It's enough to get the cops all the way into your bedroom.
Yeah, to tuck us in. How nice.
Yeah, sleep tight tonight, America.
Yeah.
The cops are on the job.
Yeah. Well, here in Denver, we've got Black Hawk helicopters flying over these days, you know, to ensure us that they'll be providing our security.
In case Osama decides to take down the Democratic Convention.
Or Code Pink. That's what they're more afraid of.
Yeah, no kidding.
You know, they're doing their thing. But, as much as I'll recognize that there are risks and stuff going on, you know, it's important to keep it in perspective, too, in a way. I mean, first off, I think, you know, most of what's thrown at us, it usually isn't physical. It's more character assassination is very big. You know, we had a high school teacher here named Jay Benish, and he was providing some, you know, radical information. Howard Zinn, how dare he, to his students, things like that.
Wasn't Ward Churchill out there, too?
Him, too, you bet. And they take these people, not just to destroy them, but it's kind of a subtle or not so subtle message to other professors, other high school teachers. Look at what can happen to you. We had one high school teacher here get the treatment from the media for wearing a button on her jacket, her winter coat that she hung up in her grade school hangar. It said, he's not my president. And the media, the talk radio here, spent a week going after this woman for that. They even got Neil Bortz involved. Or no, it was Mike Gallagher. He got Gallagher's army to go after this teacher and her principal and hound her out of the school. Who knows where she is now? But so there's that going on that I think we need to be kind of on guard against and also to respond to. But
and you know, you identify something that we've talked about in the past, Preston. Gallagher's army.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, where is Kincaid's army? Where's Malloy's army?
Right.
Where's Rachel Maddow's army? Where's Ed Schultz's army? Where's Stephanie Miller's? Where's Tom Hartman's?
Yep.
We have not fully, and I'm not talking about hounding people. I'm talking about defending them when these thugs come along to do this. And it goes to show that we've still got some turning to do on the learning curve.
Very true. You know, it's too easy to just say, you know, Bush is terrible and, all those forces out there and what's being done to us. But, you know, there's some things that we need to responsibility for ourselves, things to do for ourselves and for the larger movement, sacrifices that we need to be making that we're often not in terms of time and money and energy and effort and attention. And, you know, where are those people? Some of them are saying, well, I'm not going to get involved because I don't want to get on the FISA surveillance list.
Ooh, there was a story last week, and it was a story that I, or this week, actually. It happened last Sunday, Father's Day. I'm sure you saw it, about the little boy who was witnessed being stomped to death in California.
Jeez.
And people stopped. A couple stopped, I guess, in their 50s or 60s. And here is a man, a 27-year-old man, literally kicking and stomping a somewhere between 1 and 2 year old to death in the middle of the road. He pulled his truck over. He pulled the child out and kicked him and stomped him to death in the middle of the road. A couple stopped and tried to pull him off, but he pushed them back and went on about his business. And if he turns his back, and I'm trying to do this, Preston, this is the first time I've been able to talk about it, not because I've been gone from the mic, but because I've got the psychic distance between me and the story. I showed it to Agnes on Sunday night, and she wept and had nightmares about it. I mean, this is a level of brutality that is incomprehensible, and it is also it is certainly universal in terms of both time and geography, because that's what Jesus' entire parable of the Good Samaritan was about. A man laying in the gutter having been beaten within an inch of his life, and all of the good, pious, members of society, went to the other side of the street to get around him because he was a Samaritan and therefore an untouchable.
Mm.
Or he was an untouchable. But no, because, you know, it was nasty, and I don't want to get involved. But the Samaritan who's deemed an untouchable goes and renders aid, and the man doesn't care in his extremis that he's being helped by an untouchable. So what you had there, you know, 50, 60-year-old man, you know what? If you are alive in that situation and you've got enough strength in you to swing a tire iron, and I'm sorry to go to a violent place, but I don't think this guy could be talked down.
Mm-hmm. How old was the guy?
Well, the guy doing the stomping was 27. The intervener, the guy who tried to stop it, I never saw a story that had the formal age on it, but I think 50s or 60s, I think I was saw something. But you know what? If you're 80,
yeah,
if you can hold and swing the tire iron,
yeah,
you see what I'm saying?
Yeah. You can say stop. You can, you know, you can anything, whatever you've got.
But they made an effort, and then the effort didn't succeed. So, well, you know, okay. And I would imagine that that couple probably is in dire need of counseling right now, or some sort of grief process. The police who witnessed it, according to the chief, were given access to immediate counseling, immediate follow up, talk therapy, whatever. Because they hovered in a helicopter, Preston, with the lights beaming down into the road and watched the whole thing transpire. Then they landed in the nearest field they could get to, but the field was hemmed in by barbed wire and electric. And at that point in time, the guy finally pulled his gun and shot the killer down after, you know, it was too late.
You know, my first thought, or when I heard that story was, I was wondering if maybe the guy doing the stomping was recently off in Iraq or Afghanistan or somewhere.
One of the first things that came into my mind, too.
You know, which isn't to say we certainly have plenty of horrendous abuse going on just from people here who have lost control for a variety of reasons. But, yeah, that's definitely a shame. And, I think the Stanford Prison Experiment, was that what you were thinking of before? The people with the electrodes?
And they were told, it's okay, turn it up, turn it up, turn it up. And as long as people were given the authority to hide behind, they were willing to kill.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that was the Stanford Experiment.
Okay.
I mean, it was like 1946 or something, unless I'm mistaken. But it was a while back. But it created a complete reexamination of the nature of authority and what people would do.
Mm-hmm. And a couple other kind of loose ends on that issue of risk and activism. I mean, someone could decide to, you know, just be quiet, you know, to try to kind of protect themselves. But, you know, you could get in your car to go to your job and, you know, things like that. You can get in an accident. You know, things happen. But also to stop activism is to deny the attack that's going on in so many senses. You know, the pollution, the malnourishment, the attack on our minds, the assault on our souls, the attack on the youth of the society, the attack on other nations. You know, so us being quiet so that we avoid a possible surveillance list. Is that what's really worth protecting? You know, avoiding lists? It should be a badge of honor, you know.
And it is a badge of honor. But people are afraid of what is coming. It is future. Future fear is far more crippling than present reality. It's my theory of going to the dentist. The fear of going to the dentist is a lot more harrowing than what happens in the chair.
Yeah. And, you know, there's the fear of that, so many things, what Kate was talking about, the bugs getting us, you know?
Yeah.
And certainly there are lots of weird bugs and, you know, things being cooked up in these weapons labs, you know, biological warfare and, you know, things that might come out of climate change and on and on and on. But again, I think it's whatever, you know, come what may, it's like, what do we do while we're here? And, you know, in many ways, it's a miracle that we are here. I mean, we've come so close to nuclear exchanges, you know, all these accidental launches or, you know, showdowns in the, not just the Cuban Missile Crisis, but in the Middle East and, I think the Persian Gulf, actually, us and the Russians there again. And we're still here. That's a miracle. And we woke up this morning and tonight we'll see the moon in the sky and all these amazing things around us. And how are we going to relate to that while we're here, however long that might be? And, yeah, I think it's an honor and a privilege to try to, defend, you know, what we hold dear and to try to live free or die, I think one of our license plates says. And
well, even to go as far back as that old chestnut from Rudyard Kipling, if you can fill your race with 60 seconds run, you will be a man, my son.
Oh, great.
And, you know, how many, you know, we talk about the rat race, Preston, and we talk about, well, there's that great tune by Alabama, and I don't say that many tunes by Alabama are great, but I'm in a hurry to get things done, work and worry, and exactly.
Yeah.
But most of us, you know, it's the make it count factor, it's the earn it factor, and if you get to the, you know, there's that old thing that says the point of life is not to leave a good looking corpse that is buried in a stately funeral, but to slide sideways into the grave with a martini in one hand and a cigar in the other, screaming, "What a ride!" There's some of that. There's some of that too.
Yeah, we can have that at times.
But the point being, to and the definition is sort of slippery and hard to get your hands on, but to get to the end of it, not saying, "Well, they're gonna," but Charles Manson will probably get a sentence or two in a history book. Okay, yeah, I don't want that. But the attempt to figure out a way to use this finite time in such a way that someone changes for the good, for the positive, for the better.
Yeah.
And if we do that, and your bones are blasted into space, and nobody ever knew that you were here, the ripples in the pond will tell the tale.
Yeah.
Oh, dear God, you've led me down the philosophical garden path, Preston.
Yeah, just the joy of standing with those support. I mean, you know, being able to go to a Puerto Rican festival or, you know, go to the public library and, you know, support it if you can or make
it. Yeah, you remind me, Preston, I have to give a quick shout-out because you just brought this to mind. Some of the folks that were working at that seminar in Morgantown were just amazing people, and I have to give a shout out to Ed and Keisha and Veronica and Jill and Herbie and Tommy. These were the people who mentored my son, and they were marvelous people, and they were all at, and their focus was all on opening up horizons for young West Virginians. One of the young women that I got to talk with was from and the reason I thought about it, you said, you know, going to a Puerto Rican festival or something. She was from Kenya. And we had these abbreviated, magnificent conversations. And she opened my eyes. And, you know, when somebody can do that for you. And you know what? I'm gonna remember Veronica till I'm, God willing, hobbling around on a walker. And I'll think of her just as I think of my dear friend from my undergraduate days who's back in Japan now. This is the squishy part of the program, but there is a spiritual connectedness to that stuff.
Yeah.
And
I agree.
And you know, Ferg got to know all of these people, and I'm hoping he was transformed. Because if we are open to that transformation, then we're open to the activism that you're talking about, Preston.
Yeah. And, you know, actually, one of our Nobel Peace Prize winners was from Kenya about 4 years ago, Wangari Maathai. And she's been opening lots of eyes worldwide. And, you know, she faced lots of threats. The government was beating her up and defaming her, but she kept at it and kept at it, and now they're like another couple million trees growing in Kenya because of her efforts and that of the Greenbelt movement, and you know, planting fruit trees and you know, those things that we need, and nut trees and so forth, and saving the soil, regenerating the soil as best they can.
Yeah, Veronica said something to me, Preston. She said she was talking about her village, and she said we are able to grow everything that we need, except for sugar and salt. And then that launched us into a conversation about how people, you know, people struggle to be able to afford sugar and salt. But among other things, she said, you know, we grow corn. And she said, not like you think of corn here. Maize. She said, it's very, very sweet. And
right.
and that just set off a little flare inside my brain. And I thought of all of those fields. You know, we've been told that the corn prices are going to go through the roof because of the flooding in the Midwest. And blah, blah, blah. And it is. And it's tragic. But did anybody in the news cycle, was anybody told that those corn fields that we're talking about, were many of them were growing number two field grade hybridized corn from the Roundup Ready from Monsanto that cannot be consumed by human beings in the first place?
Right, right. Yeah, we're always being diverted away from these huge points.
Yeah, and yet that Roundup Ready Monsanto corn, if Monsanto had its way, They would plant Veronica's village with that garbage.
Yep.
And the corn that she talks about so lovingly, and I could see in the magic in her eyes, her remembering the sweetness of it, would be gone, because some corporate profiteer in America needs to add a penny to the share price and is willing to do it on the backs of people in Kenya.
Yep.
Yeah. And we're not supposed to get pissed off about that? I get pissed off about that.
Me too. I mean, some of these corporations, they should have their charters revoked. And two quick points. I know you've only got a couple minutes left here.
Go right ahead.
Yeah, profit maximization, expanding these markets. You know, that's a lot of this Iraq war was expanding markets and ramming these products down the throats of people. But previous caller Joe, I think, was talking about one of his roommates working from 6 in the morning to 11 p.m., you know, truly being in the rat race. And I noticed something about Russert's death, a theme that kept coming up that was kind of, bothering me. He kept telling that story. He replays interviews with Hannity or whoever about his book, Big Rust, about his father, and how his father had worked two full-time jobs for 30 years, 80 hours a day, would come home, take a cat nap, go back to work, and he never complained. Russert kept saying that, and he never complained.
And he never complained.
It's something being dropped, you know,
why are you complaining? You're not supposed to complain.
Exactly.
Well, you know, Bart Kopp observed, Preston, that on the one hand, he wrote his book, Big Russ, and I had the best father in the world, but there was always a but, and the but was that he was never, you know, he was always working, he was never there for my ball games, he was never, never this, never, you know, he didn't see me grow up, yada, 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 and the light never went on for Russert. That maybe there's something wrong with working a human being to death, and that there is a fundamental human value in seeing your kids grow up, in being there to offer encouragement and advice.
Right, right. And so the way they were framing this argument, it was like hard to be against because, you know, sacrifice, and this dad must love him so much, but, you know, maybe he should have complained. One of Martin Luther King's last March was with sanitation workers in Memphis who were being worked to death.
Yeah.
And so anyway, I just wanted to mention that. And real quickly, two resources on the issue of transit and how our communities, the suburbs, have been designed to make us dependent on the car. Again, cars can be great, very useful things. I'm not denying that. In Sweden, most people have cars, and really safe cars like Volvos. But they have the option of walking, biking, mass transit. and two movies, one called The End of Suburbia and kind of the sequel to that called Escape from Suburbia. Very enlightening documentaries. I think Sundance Channel showed Escape from Suburbia recently. And there's a lot of interesting, you know, there's an interesting movement, a lot of new thoughts about these issues of new urbanism and how we can better design our cities to decrease what's always being put forward as a need.
Exactly.
Our energy needs.
Preston, I wish I had more.